Hello.
Buongiorno.
It's more like Buenos Aires, but that's cool. Sure.
Well, no, but I mean, I was saying that because it's timeless whenever the listeners listen to it.
Oh,
Unless you assume
sure.
all of our listeners listen at night.
Yes, I assume they listen to it at approximately the same time in the day that we record it, because that's how podcasts work.
Yes.
I think.
Okay.
It's been a very long time. I'm not entirely sure how these things work.
All right. Well, good night, everybody. Show's over.
Well, that's the other one, Buena Notte. Yeah, that one.
Okay.
I am very tired though. I'm still kind of on the wrong time zone, so.
Can you tell everyone where they can find the show notes?
Yes, actually,
No.
because this is episode 53, right? Because we just did the 52.
Yes.
So yeah, defocus.co/53. We don't have anything in those show notes of note, as far as I'm aware yet, but
Well, that's because we haven't had a show yet.
well, just because we don't have anything really that we're going to talk about other than a movie.
But we have it's the quantum supposition of a quantum superposition of having both everything and nothing in the show notes right now because we haven't talked about anything. So it could be all of the things in human existence, or it could be absolutely nothing, and no one will know.
So at the moment right now is Schrodinger's show notes.
That is a fact. That is a dead cat fact. Dead slash live cat fact.
Is that one of those things you can sign people up and they'll send you text messages about dead cats?
Yeah.
How you been?
I'm peachy. I am just peachy. How are you? You were away from your precious United States and your precious home and your precious Phoenix and your pug and everything.
Why is everything so precious to me?
I don't know. I just kind of always saw you as more of a Gollum figure, I guess. Oh, yeah, you
I'm
never
gonna
saw the
pretend to be
movies.
insulted, but yeah, I don't exactly know what that means because I don't care for Lord of the Rings.
Well, I just go for laughs from the audience. You're all laughing, right? Yes. Okay. Moving on. So how was Italy?
Italy was good. It was busy. It was a lot of long days, a lot of walking. But it was fun. Saw a lot of different stuff. It was one of those fun family tours where you're guided all around the country by a local fella. His name was Marco. He was very nice.
Okay. Did you
Not
did anyone
your
did
Marco. It was
anyone
different Marco.
did anyone say polo?
I think he did.
Oh. That kind of takes the fun out of it if he makes the joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, what parts of Italy did you see? I'm sure our audience is interested to know, especially since we have a few Italians in our audience.
We do?
I thought we did.
Oh yeah, we do. Yeah. So sorry, it's very late. It's not late, I'm just very tired. We saw
It's
a
very
lot of
note right
places.
now.
Yes, it's very note. Let's see. There was Rome, Sorrento, Capri, Florence, Venice, Milan. I'm skipping a few.
You skipped the machine.
I skipped the machine.
Yeah, Florence and the Machine.
Oh God. You're the worst.
Did you miss me?
Yes. Thank you for both distracting and frustrating. I gotta be on my toes, apparently. I'm not used to expecting that kind of nonsense.
Yes. You gotta be on point, as they say.
Oh, there was also Como was the other one, the lake where George Clooney and Mussolini lived.
Okay. I think you could have just gotten away with saying one of those things.
Well, they pointed out all the houses as we drove around in the boat.
Oh, okay. Did they point out the didn't George Lucas use that for like the Naboo lake scene in episode two? When he's all like, "Oh, sand is so rough, but not like your skin," and it's just like, "Oh, I'm gonna vomit." You remember that?
I don't exactly have that scene front of mind, but that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, well, I thought that was Lake Cuomo, but yeah.
I also saw the monument and the gravesite to Napoleon's dogs. That's there.
Wow.
Yeah. He had a summer house there or something, and one of his dogs died, so he buried him. And there's like a little monument.
Is it a dog-sized monument?
No, it's an obelisk. There are a lot of obelisks in Italy.
Oh, that's because you know what it was. It was the style at the time.
God damn it. So, welcome back. Hi.
I missed you.
Yeah, I missed this too. I'm woefully unprepared as usual.
Hi, we were ever prepared.
How was your 2 weeks of not doing this show?
Well, it turned out to be kind of absolutely insane. So it was a good thing we actually did pre-record everything. My friend, the roboticist, came in to do the DARPA challenge thing in Pomona with the robots and stuff, and I sent it to you. And most of them fell over. and there were some really impressive kind of slash creepy ones that did well in the thing, but. So that was cool, but then he stayed with me for like a week after that, and immediately when he was leaving, I got sucked into doing like massive overtime and weekends on an emergency last minute project, and so then I had absolutely no time for anything. So it worked out really well that we had pre-recorded everything, and that would have sucked, but I'm glad everyone's glad right now. Just really
everyone's glad.
You
got your overtime, and I got to walk around in a sweaty, humid city.
Mm-hmm. And now you're back in a sweaty, hot, dry city.
Oh God! It's after 9 p.m. and it's still 100 degrees outside. And of course, being the hottest room in the house, the office here, it is quite warm in here.
Yeah. And as we are speaking before the show, my luxurious LG wall unit AC, which was brand new as of a year ago, seems to have gone kaput. So it'll be interesting how that goes this evening. There is a backup portable unit that is inside of the bedroom area, you know, where the magic happens. And that one's ready to kick in. But it would be nice if the living room unit wasn't completely broken before I left town, because I am also going on vacation relatively soon. But
summertime.
Yeah, it's like there's vacations or things or stuff.
it's the time for all the great vacations, the summertime.
All the great vacations.
Are you going to go somewhere warmer or cooler than your current location?
I'm not sure. They say that like the trade winds are good, so there's good cross breeze and stuff. Also, I'm pretty sure that the Grand Hyatt has a AC unit. We'll be going to Kauai in the volcanic island chain of Hawaii, which is where they film all the helicopter shots for what the perimeter of the Isla Nublar, that thing, the Jurassic Park island. That's what they use for that is Kauai.
Yeah, I saw that there was a credit for the Hawaii unit.
Mm-hmm. And tax credits if you stayed at the end. I haven't figured out what the Canadian tax credits were for yet. I was going to try to look that up, but then I just was like, meh. Because the movie was made with Louisiana tax credits for most of the shooting, some Hawaii tax credits for some of the helicoptery vistas and stuff, and Canadian tax credits, which baffle me because I don't know what Quebec did exactly for this, but it was mentioned in the thing. There was a logo.
It's got to be post, doesn't it?
It's got to be, but ILM, I think, did the lion's share of this, so maybe they did like some screen inserts or something. I don't know what they did.
Well, there was quite a bit of work in here. I mean, you know, somebody could have they could have farmed out the control center stuff to a separate company.
Yeah, that's what I meant by the inserts. The display inserts. That could have been the case. It's not like you need like, you know, dinosaur level stuff for display inserts these days for little heart monitors dropping out. But we should probably, I guess, get into the movie so that you don't die in sweltering heat in Arizona in the desert. Because that would just kind of suck. But at least you could say you saw a lot of Italy. So there's that.
Yeah, I saw a lot of Italy. And before I forget, I watched a bunch of movies on the airplanes, which was... I guess more interesting than doing nothing, but I watched Hot Tub Time Machine 2, Jupiter Ascending, and I watched Age of Ultron again on a 4-inch touchscreen LCD with terrible, it looked like inverted black levels or something, but it was very bad. And
That's how I saw Green Lantern, was on my way back from the United Kingdom on a British Airways flight, and they had like the little 4-inch LCD screen with the inverted color and like those little like pressure dots in the screen, like in a grid. Remember like the old Tiger toys that had like the touch screens, but it was really like they would only sample where you had touched on those little specific plastic points that were on the screen. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those. It was a good viewing experience because it was an awful movie. But
well, it essentially put me to sleep.
Yeah. So Jupiter Ascending, you're giving it 2 thumbs up, right?
Oh my goodness. You know, there's some interesting stuff in there just in terms of like the themes and the ideas, but good Lord, is that a terrible movie.
I'm actually, don't spoil it, because I actually kind of want to see it.
You should. You really should.
Because it just seems like such a train wreck that I have to see it, or else I'm just not going to believe it when people describe it to me. so you know, I want to do that.
I did listen to the Flophouse episode about it, which it came out like a day after I saw it or whatever. But I listened through it. And it's like they don't even have to make jokes. They're basically just describing the plot, and it's ridiculous. And I'm like, yeah, that is what I recall seeing happen. And that is quite absurd.
Yeah. Well.
But still, there are some interesting themes in there. I like some of the concepts well enough that I hope somebody makes a movie about them, but just not this movie.
Yeah. Well, you can say that a lot about the Wachowski movies since the first Matrix movie, basically.
Mm. Yeah, there were some Matrix-y bits in this one, too.
Mm, good.
Similar themes.
I love themes. speaking of... I saw... I don't know if our listeners are... Well, our listeners are probably familiar with... The Mike at the Movies segments that started on Upgrade on Relay FM, and then they've also done one now on Analog. And so I actually had the excuse to watch Sneakers, which up until now I thought was a Michael Douglas movie with Demi Moore, and it was not that.
I was wondering why you were so resistant when I suggested it, but you just like scoffed at me for making reference to it from time to time. But no, now you go see it because Mike watched it.
Well, no, but in my head, I thought it was this other movie. Like, you just have to watch the trailer for this. Like, it is an absurd film. I'd seen parts of it on TV, and I'd seen the trailer before. So I thought that was what Sneakers was. Like, it somehow the wires got crossed, and that's what it was in my mind. And then I was like, oh, it's actually not that. It's a Robert Redford movie, and it looks pretty interesting. So I watched it. We might still do that in a future episode of this podcast, because I quite enjoyed it, and I do not feel like the Analog episode does it justice. Sorry,
ooh,
Mike.
Burn.
Yeah, but then they also did Say Anything for his episode with Jason Snell, and it was, as we've discussed, John Cusack is not my favorite, and this turns out to be my least favorite John Cusack movie I've ever seen, so I don't understand. It's everyone else's favorite, like, honestly. I have not run into someone who doesn't like Say Anything other than myself. So, you know, you could just chalk that one up to be me being crazy. But somehow that's the situation, is that movie's awful. And I would have just rather sat through a whole entire movie from the Fraser Crane dad point of view of that film, about his, well, let's just say financial difficulties. And that would have been more interesting than,
than young
that.
Love and complicated relationships.
But it wasn't... It's just stupid. Like, they were just idiots. It bothered me.
Everyone's an idiot in high school.
I know. Well, we've clearly established that. especially in Toto's Hey Now, You're an All-Star, one of our first couple episodes of our show, which actually I was reminded of quite a bit. So I'm sure that when they did, you know, Can't Hardly Wait, they went back and quite heavily lifted from... Say Anything, because there seem to be some scenes and bits and little bits and bobs that have repeated themselves in the 90s version.
Yeah, but they were fun, lovable idiots and Can't Hardly Wait. It's a little extra serious in Say Anything.
I didn't even find it that serious. It was just sort of like eye rolling. But this isn't a podcast.
I can absolutely picture you eye rolling at Say Anything pretty much the whole way through.
Yeah. I never for one second bought into them as people So it was totally not for me. Everyone else loves the movie, so if you love it, Godspeed. You know, shine on, you crazy diamonds, as someone might say. But
it's fine.
Yes. Do you love it, Dan?
I wouldn't say that I love it. I've seen it maybe 2.5 times. It's certainly not my favorite John Cusack movie. But it's a little heavier than most of the movies of that time. But you know, it has its warrants, so it's fine.
I mean, I like all the musical choices in it, but I just bleh. This isn't a show about what other people talk about on other podcasts. This is a show about what we talk about on our podcast, because that's the kind of podcast this is.
This isn't a show about tough high school relationships and realistic, you know, feelings and representations of the complications of life. This is a show about the gritty, real world life of dinosaur trainers.
Yes, and raptor motorcycle gangs, the women who go on one date with them. So you should probably start at the beginning. And at the beginning, there was Jurassic Park, a film which came out when I was a very young kid, and there were big news reports about how violent and crazy and scary it was, and how parents really shouldn't really take their kids to go see it. And we begged and begged and begged, and my mom finally took us to go see it, and it was amazing, and I loved it, and it was awesome, and that was huge for me at the time to see this film. When I saw Lost World, the follow-up sequel done 2 years later by Steven Spielberg, I was incredibly disappointed as a child. And maybe one could say that started me down the path of disappointment for everything, but I just...
For your entire life?
Yeah. It is not a good film. It is like two different movies that are glued together, and it's just... It is a mess. And we recently rewatched all of them. Because my boyfriend apparently thought he saw the original film, but what he thought he saw was Lost World. And right now, he thinks that's still the best one after we watched all of the others. And I'm confused, because that doesn't sound right to me. Lost World is not a good movie, but he still likes that one the most. I mean, I'm just chalking that one up to nostalgia, because I can't fathom why.
I can barely even remember what happened in The Lost World. I know it's Jeff Goldblum, and there's some trailers and some T-Rexes and stuff, and a baby T-Rex. But that's about all I got.
And Julianne Moore.
Right, of course.
Yes, yes. Doing some sort of weird accent that is sneakers-worthy, shall we say. It is not a good accent, whatever it is that she's mangling.
How did they get on the island, and why? I remember the San Diego bit, which was completely absurd, but how and why did they get back on the island?
Okay, so listeners, if you really care deeply about this, then don't, because I'm just going to spoil it anyways, but you really shouldn't change the channel, because just listen. And also, there's not really channels, because it's a podcast, but that's beside the point. There was apparently this other island, Isla whatever it was, started with an S. These details are not important. And it was Site B, and it was apparently where they bred the dinosaurs before they brought them over to the main dinosaur island, except for the little showroom breeding area that they had on the actual island. So that was where all these other dinosaurs were, and they were supposed to die off because of the lysine contingency, but they didn't. They learned to eat some plants that had lysine in them, and then they survived. And so life finds a way. And they had a whole ecosystem of these dinosaurs on this island. And John Hammond had become a bit of a naturalist and wanted to send Jeff Goldblum and a team of people in there to go catalog and document and stuff and come back out of it with that. And then his nephew? Son? I can't remember exactly. There is a close relation of his that turns out to be a complete jerk. That one... wanted to go in guns a-blazing, capture all the dinosaurs, and take them to San Diego to put on display, King Kong style. And there is, of course, this whole King Kong theme of this throughout the whole film. And they go and they do the stuff, and there's that guy who was in Romeo and Juliet that I can't remember his name of, and he's like the headhunter guy, and he disappears halfway through the movie because his part of the movie's over, and then it goes on to San Diego part of the movie. And they take the baby T-Rex to the in the boat over to the mainland, but the mom snuck on board in the cargo hold, and somehow there's a half-chewed arm that was steering the boat into the dock, which doesn't make any sense, because what chewed off its arm? Everything's in the cargo hold. So it's not like the T-Rex reached in and bit his arm off through the doorway. It doesn't make any sense. That boat crashed, and they let the dinosaur out, and it went after its kid, and the kid was over at the Jurassic Park theme place that they were going to show it in the arena, and so they rescue the they take the dino, and they drive it back out, and they lure the T-Rex back to the thing and take it back to the island, and that's the end of that film. And then the third movie, Jurassic Park 3.
Do we have to?
Yeah, we gotta discuss it, because in a way there are some things that are touched on in this film. It starts off with us and Sam Neill again, and this time it's he's got a team together, and they're 3D printing the bony region of where they would make sounds for the velociraptors so that they can try to see what sounds they make. And it's like, well, this is stupid. You have a whole island full of these things. But
those aren't real dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are dead. Those are just, what do you call them?
Monsters.
Like fun park, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. It was ridiculous. It is the case that they are not genuinely the creatures from 65 million years ago, but close enough. Closer than you get with a 3D printer and like some bro. Sam Neill and some bro go to the island on a mission funded by this couple where they want to fly over the island. Turns out they don't want to fly over the island. They want to land because their kid is on the island somewhere. They go through this whole process. They find out that the parents are actually divorced. They don't have any money. And that they were doing this whole mission to rescue their kid because no one would come in and rescue them. They go through the whole rigmarole of trying to get them off the island. They come up with a bigger, badder dinosaur who was somehow bred but never talked about in the previous two movies. And that's on the island. And it fights a T-Rex and stuff. And that's important because you need to show that it's even crazier than having a T-Rex. And then there's an aviary and all kinds of stuff. And they finally get off that. And they use the raptor 3D printed thing to communicate with the other raptors so that they can talk to them and convince them not to eat them and give them the egg back. And so that is your movie there for your Jurassic Park 3. It was not well liked. It was directed.
There's a little more in there with like the stealing of the eggs and the blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that's pretty much it. They land, they find the kid, and then they try to escape. And then, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. And in all of these films, the common theme is that man is man's own worst enemy, and that man grossly underestimates nature and God, or whatever you however you want to term it, and so that man will, you know, greedily trade out these resources in a vain attempt to get what they want, and that happens in three movies, and so that brings us to Jurassic Park 4, which is Jurassic World, which continuity-wise is in kind of a weird spot. I haven't actually figured out exactly where this falls, because it sort of acknowledges the previous film, Jurassic Park, directly. It doesn't, mm-hmm. it doesn't acknowledge the existence of the sequels to Jurassic Park. But it doesn't deny that they could have happened in the intervening time. So it's just sort of like this is kind of weird. And there are themes from those movies which show up in this film of the raptors communicating, of InGen, corporate security, jerkwads, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's just sort of like, I don't know what you guys are going for here. But that is where we are. And we had some trailer episodes, as I'm sure maybe some people have probably heard, where we were trying to dissect whether or not people were doing a good job marketing these films that were coming out at the time. And Dan and I think, decidedly came down on Jurassic World not being a good marketing effort. and being insulting, and the premise being ridiculous, and that I believe I went on an extended rant about how I would never go see this film. So
that sounds about like you.
Yeah, like what was it? 2 days ago? 3 days ago? I went to, and I saw this film. So you know that I guess just never believed me about anything. You know
they got you.
Yeah, Joe lies. And so I went and I saw this, and of course, glorious 2D. And
the only way to see it.
Yes, really, because it was converted. So you're wasting your money, people. And I don't want to hear any of this like IMAX experience bullshit. It wasn't shot in IMAX. Get off your high horse. It was just blown up. So the film starts off with the Isla Nublar and the eggshell cracking of the dinosaurs getting out of the eggs. And, you know, of course, they're CG dinosaurs. It's not like the egg cracking from the first film, where it was like little puppets, which didn't really seem convincing back then.
I kind of felt a little nostalgic for the puppets when I was watching the CG one go down. I was like, oh, I liked the one where it just kind of pushed its head gently out instead of using the little claw to dig its way out.
I think my problem with the CG one is that it was too articulate. I think that it could have just been like closed eyes and stuff. Like, I don't think I am not aware of anything that pops out of an egg just like glaring at you. I don't think that happens.
Well, a genetically modified dinosaur might do that.
Yeah, with cuttlefish DNA. But I'm getting ahead of us. So that happens, and then we get the close-up on the snow, and then this giant claw comes down, and then we reveal that it's a macro shot of a tiny little bird, and the tiny little bird flies away. Which is, of course, a reference to Sam Neill in the original film, talking about how dinosaurs are really birds, blah, 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 blah. It's kind of a ridiculous shot, but I chuckled when I first saw it happen. The
it's also accompanied by like a T-Rex volume thud of the leg hitting the ground, just to kind of mess with you.
Yeah, because you need that for scale. But the that happens, and it flies away, and we reveal the house, and we get the shot inside the kid's room. It's this little kid who's got like raggy hair and like. He's playing with his Viewmaster, and there's little tin robots on the back shelf behind him and lunchboxes and stuff. And I was like, is this like some sort of a flashback to when Chris Pratt was a kid, you know, like Guardians of the Galaxy style? Because this doesn't really seem like a modern child and a modern child's bedroom. But that does seem to be what they are inferring by when we cut off to the next scene where they're walking past the teenage son who has Beats and is on his phone, and you're like, okay, so that wasn't a flashback. That was like totally supposed to be real day, modern day, where some little kid is using a Viewmaster for dinosaurs. So that was a novelty. I think that was indulgent on the filmmaker's part. And I think that was a direct nod to, like, his own childhood, or at least of films that he saw when he was a child, because I that's not even close to being what reality is these days, or you know, for like the past 20 years. So we established that Judy Greer, wonderful, marvelous Judy Greer, is the mother of these two kids, which is like what happened really, because this is Hollywood sexism really, because she was like the romantic lead, friend in a lot of things for a really long time. And mm-hmm. She was a voice in Archer, and she's great. I think she's hilarious. And she all of a sudden winds up as being someone's mom. And it seems like that would like what took 2 seconds. And she has two teenage kids now. That's it's Hollywood sexism is what I say. Poppycock. And so we established that the parents are taking the kids off to the airport to go to Jurassic World, which seems ill-advised by themselves. I mean, in a way it's supposed to be like they're going to Disney World or like they're going to Universal Studios, but in a way it's not, because there was a massive, you know, failure of the first park, which is acknowledged in this film, of people dying. So maybe just a little more caution.
But they're going to go hang out with Judy Greer's sister, who apparently runs the park. And, you know, they kind of led you to believe that it was going to be a family thing. And then they're just kind of like, well, we're dropping them off at the airport. Okay, bye. But I guess sort of we subtly get around to later that they're doing this because they need some alone time because they're getting a divorce, which is a plot point for no reason whatsoever.
None. I'm really angry about that plot point, by the way. Okay.
Yeah.
In the third movie, it was a huge plot point that the parents were divorced. Huge plot point. The parents were divorced. In this movie, they bring it up again. It's like, why do we need a second Jurassic Park movie where the parents are divorced? At least going through the process of getting a divorce. And it was so ridiculous because it had nothing to do with the plot of this one. It wasn't about like some strange couple coming back together to rescue their kid. It was this couple sending their kids away and they're going to go get a divorce in a lawyer's office and then never talk about it for the rest of the film. But one time the kid is going to cry about it on the monorail for like 5 seconds. What the?
The moral of the story is when life gets tough and your parents are getting divorced and you're really sad, go look at some dinosaurs.
Yeah. When life gives you dino DNA, make dinosaurs. But
did you see Mr. DNA made a cameo in this one?
I did. Did you see that the voice of Mr. DNA is Colin Trevorrow?
Is it really?
Yes, he cast himself in the voice of Mr. DNA.
How dare he!
So, is there anything you'd like to say about the direction of this film yet, or do you want to just wait till later?
You know. I'll wait mostly till later. One of the things while we're towards the beginning of this film that really kind of bugged the crap out of me is there are like 4 or 5 instances of them doing this like 1,000 foot up in the air like helicopter shot where they kind of like fly in over the Disneyland main street of all of the buildings like towards the little pyramid building. But they do it. They don't do it just once to like introduce like here's what the park looks like. They do it like every time they cut back to something that kind of takes place in one of those buildings. They do this like long, slow, high up in the air fly-in shot. It's like why are we doing this again? It's one of those things that it's supposed to like show you the massive scope of this park, but it just kept making it feel small to me because it's like we built this model sort of city in CG here. We really want to show it to you as many times as possible so you can see how cool it looks. And it's just like, why am I looking at this over and over again? This like slow flying shot, like I'm Spider-Man over the top of the main street. It was really weird.
I really would have preferred a couple up angle establishing shots and then that would be it. Just so we can get a sense of height. Cause I don't think when you're that high up, you get a sense of the scale appropriately. Cause everything seems like a miniature. But you know, whatever. The important takeaway from that shot is the Samsung Innovation Center.
There are some brands all over this movie, aren't there?
Yeah. You know, and the movie itself is making fun of the fact that there are brands all over this movie.
Yeah, but then they also do it, too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. That gets to a central problem I have with the tongue-in-cheek nature of this film, where... It's one thing to be tongue-in-cheek about, you know, wow factor and all this stuff, but then to literally go through all of the motions of taking it seriously, you know, you lose your credit for doing the tongue-in-cheek stuff.
A little bit.
Yeah, so, like, when we establish that Claire is talking to the, like, 3 investor-seeming guys or clients or consultants or however their business arrangement is, and then they leave, and then she's like, yep, we have the Verizon sponsored Indominus Rex, and you know, I laughed because that's ridiculous, but then you realize Samsung literally is funding this film. Everyone is using a Samsung phone, and the you know, the other Jurassic Park movies weren't shy about this kind of product integration. Notably in Jurassic World, everybody's driving those Mercedes around, so it's pretty silly. The thing here, of course, like I said, is that it's one thing to like put a lantern on it and say like, oh, isn't this ridiculous? But then to literally follow through with it being a totally serious thing afterwards, I'm not on board with. Especially when we get to the final act of the film, but I don't want to skip ahead to that. Let's continue with the stuff that happens. We establish our characters, the control room, Lauren Lapkus, and James M. Johnson, I want to say.
Jake.
Is it Jake?
It's Jake Johnson.
Okay, whatever.
You need to watch more New Girl. He's funny.
Okay. Well, I don't watch New Girl. But so Jake and Lauren, who have characters in the movie that I can't remember the name of.
His name is apparently Lowry, and she is Vivian.
Really? Did they even refer to them by name in the film? I feel like there was not a lot of establishing work done for them. But you know, Jake is kind of a skinnier Dennis Nedry, I guess, in that he's kind of the irreverent punk jerk in the control center, and he's got his Jurassic Park shirt on, which greatly upsets Claire, played by Bryce Dallas Howard. And
well, he's kind of the anti Dennis Nedry because he's a good guy. He's an idealist. He's all about, you know, dinosaurs are cool enough, man. You know, that first park was legit. It didn't have to genetically modify crazy dinosaurs and stuff. It just had dinosaurs and everyone was in awe of that.
Yes.
I mean, sure, a lot of people died, but I mean, it was something.
He's a hipster, Nedry.
he certainly is with the glasses and the mustache.
Yes. God, those glasses. And his retro shirt. So he's there wearing his retro shirt for the entire film.
Which, as an aside, while we're talking about the fact that he was super proud that he found an original Jurassic Park shirt on eBay, and slightly jumping ahead, we see that, like, the original Welcome Center from the first movie is still somewhat intact. Like, why didn't he just, like, cruise over there and, like, root through all the stuff that was presumably abandoned? He could probably find a whole stack of them.
Well, it was in the restricted area, which was somewhere between two steps and 5 miles from the actual park border. I don't know if you notice this later on when we get there, but the geography of how long it takes to get to anywhere on this island varies quite a bit between editing cuts. Maybe he just didn't feel like taking up the time to wait for the editing cut that would magically zip him over there really fast.
Well, we get a little bit of sort of geometry when they say the Indominus Rex is 4 miles from the fence, and you can sort of see the beeping dot and then the lines on the graph on the screen, which kind of made it look like the whole island was, I don't know, what, like 30 miles across?
It doesn't matter, because the Indominus Rex somehow, like, goes south really fast and then doubles back somehow to the visitor center, because the visitor center was not south of where it was going. It doesn't make any sense. The way the geography of that works out is not good. But the like you said, we're getting ahead. Let's finish up in the control center. So we establish Jake's character irreverence, blah, 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 blah. And then she goes to talk to her boss, Irfan Khan, who is playing Mizrani, I want to say.
Yeah, Mizrani.
Mizrani. Okay, Mr. Mizrani. And he's in a helicopter, and he's almost got his helicopter license. He's very happy about it, and he kind of does his little helicopter thing. I generally liked his character, although I have some criticisms.
he started off really good. He was kind of John Hammondy. He was silly. He loved dinosaurs. He was idealistic. He wasn't in it for the buck, and he was just kind of a character. And then as the movie goes on, he just gets kind of dumb.
Yes, incredibly dumb. And also gullible, and I question his management strategy. So they go on their helicopter ride to the Indominus paddock, and they go walk inside, and it's the big ominous thing of, oh, they demanded that we make the walls higher because it's bigger than we expected. Ooh, scary. They go inside, and they have their little booth with the glass and the tablets on little podiums, and she, like, every time she walks into this room, she just pokes some buttons on there. I don't know what it's doing, but I guess there's something to do just to look busy.
She's just checking her Twitter feed while she's looking at the paddock there.
Oh yeah, yeah. She's just looking at her faves. So they go up there, and he's like, oh, I can't really see it. And then, like, you know, it's sort of like through the trees. You see, like, some parts of the spine of it, and he's like, oh, it's white and it's so scary, and the kids are going to be scared and the parents are going to be scared. It's going to be great. We're going to make so much money from this. Which doesn't seem very John Hammondy.
No.
And especially considering the last appearance of John Hammond in the second film, was that he was a naturalist and didn't want to, you know, mess with the natural order that was being established by the animals surviving by themselves against all odds on the island. So, again, calls into question some continuity concerns. So I don't know how this is put in with everything else then. There's also a statue of Hammond, which is a little strange, inside the Innovation Center.
You know what she says, though? The realities of running a business require that we make money or something, something.
Yeah, and he's like, well, you should talk to the raptor trainer that we have, who was a former Navy something-something SEAL or whatever.
How many times did they say that he was from the Navy?
I don't know, like 12.
How many things did he do that kind of gave us a hint that he was from the Navy?
None.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe he just wasn't very good, and that's why he went to go be a dinosaur trainer.
If he was some wackadoodle backwoods dude who was just, like, able to commune with animals super well, I don't think that would have made a difference to his character instead of, like, being hardened Navy guy.
Yeah, well, so she grudgingly accepts that she'll go talk to him, and then we establish the guy who has the raptor thing, and there's the whole scene of him, like, getting them to accept his commands when he's up on the little plank thing that's above them on that little tiny railing, which seems totally not safe. And then, of course, 5 minutes later, totally not safe, new trainee guy goes to fetch a pig with a little loop thing and gets sucked into the raptor paddock. And then he has to go in after him and save him, and he's using clicker.
Must be a very important pig that they had to save it.
No, well, it must have not been a very important guy that he didn't want to shock the raptors rather than, like, risk injury to him.
For a trainer, I understood what he was saying. Like, if you hit him with electricity when I'm trying to calm him down, they'll never trust me again. Like, I got that, but, like, why did they care so much about the pig that they had to fish it out? Like, let him eat the pig. You can get another pig. What's so important about that pig?
I don't know, but what I'm saying is, like, it doesn't make any sense that they would even try to risk someone's life over this, over the training of the raptors, because if you have a dead person on your hands and your raptors, you didn't excel at training them, and you're going to get your pants sued off.
Well, it's a side project, and that is the goal. Like, the goal of their project of training the raptors is to see if they'll follow commands, and you really need to make sure that they trust you at all costs. So
yeah. And then, of course, we have Vincent D'Onofrio waltzing in.
Why? I mean, I guess, again, spoiler, I guess you need somebody to be that, like, backstabbing above your pay grade, you never saw it coming dude in the third act, but...
I saw it coming. Who didn't see it coming? When you saw Vincent D'Onofrio come in, you're just like, hello, Vincent D'Onofrio, bad guy of this film.
His first scene is so long, where he's talking to Chris Pratt about all the great things that they need to do, all the militarization of the dinosaurs, because they're the best killing machines, and blah, blah, blah. We need to send them in on the battlefield. It's like, what are you talking about, you insane person?
Yeah, you're not going to train them to... diffuse missiles or torpedoes or some dipshit like that. Are you?
No, he's just going to.
It was a Star Trek 4 reference, but I kind of horribly mangled it.
Sure, okay.
You watched it. I made you watch it.
The diffuse missiles? What? The whales were going to diffuse missiles?
No. Remember when they were showing their interest in the whales, and then Dr. Jillian was just like, "You're not going to make them, like, you know, trying to train them to retrieve torpedoes or some dipshit." Stuff like that, and then Kirk says, "No, ma'am, no dipshit like that." Remember that?
Vaguely remember that. Yes, I don't remember missiles, but yeah.
All right. Well, I don't think he actually said missiles. I think he said torpedoes. I think she said torpedoes. But
either way, it's Star Trek. Whales. Sure, yes. Star Trek over my head. It's on brand.
Yes, dinosaurs.
Yeah, like of all the things, I mean. If we're to take as read that sort of InGen at this point is corporatized and they're just doing what they can do to grab as much cash as they can out of dinosaurs, do they really think the militarization of dinosaurs is the best way to go? Like, sure, government contracts are incredibly lucrative, but really? Like, just let people come look at them and take their money for doing that, and you don't have to worry about, like, accidentally dying.
Well, I think we clearly establish in this opening scene, and then in subsequent scenes, that Vincent D'Onofrio underestimates the amount of effort required to train and control the animals, let's say. And so, you know...
And I guess they try and hit that pretty hard, don't they? Yeah. That's kind of the whole point of that scene, is to show Chris Pratt going like, no, you don't understand. They're going to eat me in a heartbeat, even though it looks like they're listening to me. Like, they're still not even remotely trainable. They're wild animals, and you just pop in from time to time to see the successes here and there.
Yeah. And Vincent D'Onofrio is evil, so of course he's still going to do whatever he's going to do. And I don't understand the management structure here, because somehow Vincent D'Onofrio works for Engine Security, who somehow works for Mr. Mizrani, but somehow when Mizrani's taken out, Vincent D'Onofrio is put in charge. And he has a team of people who landed in boats and stuff, and Omar Sy is like, oh, this is bad, I'm going to tell somebody about it, and he can't. And then Omar Sy doesn't do anything for the rest of the movie, basically, except hide in a log. Omar Sy is introduced in this opening scene as well. And like I'm saying, he doesn't do much in this film. He just serves to support everything that Chris Pratt says. And then, ta-da. Follow-up to this, of course, we get all of the scenes of the kids, like, going around to different stuff, and they go to the, like, little petting zoo ride thing.
They run away from Claire's assistant and start going on all of the dangerous rides, which I don't know why they couldn't have gone on those rides with her, but they felt the need to escape because she was talking on her phone.
Yeah, from Zara, who, instead of reporting that she lost them, just decided to just wander around for a couple hours. I don't understand.
Is it too early to get into what happens to her? Because I did not like that at all.
Like, no, I don't like what happened with Zara at all. I don't think it was good.
It was unwarranted. It was violent. It was not in line with the rest of this movie. It didn't feel like the kind of thing like in Jurassic Park where the accountant was a jackass and hid in the bathroom and got eaten. Like, he deserved that. Like Zara, that was just uncalled for, and just genuinely made me feel bad when I saw that.
Well, yeah, and it was gratuitous. It was like Saw gore porn. She got killed by like five different dinosaurs. She's, you know, carried off by a pterodactyl. Drops her into the water, tries to drown her over and over and over again. Mosasaurus comes up, eats her and the pterodactyl. And it was just like, what a horrible ending. And the whole time the kids are watching and they're just like, oh, mouths agape, not being attacked by dinosaurs. Cause whenever you're watching somebody get killed by dinosaurs, you have a magic shield around you that protects you.
And it wasn't even one of those things where it was like, now the kids saw how serious this whole thing is, and now they're going to like, pull their heads out of their butts and like actually try and save themselves. It was just like, no, you're already in the middle of this giant mess of dinosaurs running for your life, and this is just something that had to happen, apparently.
No one cared about Zara's death. No one. Not a single person in this movie.
I cared about it. Well, oh no, not in the movie. No. Cared about it, but in the sense that I didn't want it to happen because it was horrible.
Well, but see, here's the thing. I didn't feel like attached to her, but at the same time I felt like we were introduced to her, so it seemed kind of, I don't know, rude to get rid of her so summarily, but they dispatched her.
Yeah, I wouldn't say we were attached to her, but she didn't present herself as a kind of person that we would like feel okay about watching be gratuitously murdered.
Yeah, well, you know, you don't usually get to pick who gets gratuitously murdered in real life, Dan. This is like real life. This is exactly like real life.
Exactly, it's exactly like real life. Yeah.
Yes.
Even the guy in the first Jurassic Park who gets eaten by the raptors, the guy with the hat with the flap up on the side.
Yeah.
Even him, you can tell he's accepted his position. Like, he's the guy who's going to have to get down and dirty and go shoot the dinosaurs when it comes down to it. And, you know, he tries to sacrifice himself to save the other people, and he gets eaten, and that's fine. You feel a little bit bad about it, but like, it was for a purpose. Like, her death was just so out of nowhere and unnecessary that it just really bugged the crap out of me. But we'll let it go and keep moving now.
Yeah, but, you know, I felt bad about Sam Jackson's death. Poor guy.
Well, yeah, but he was also a little bit of a jerk.
All right, well, listeners, write in and give your opinion about Sam Jackson. So
we're not talking about Sam Jackson. We're talking about the polite British lady who got eaten by a pterodactyl and a big fish thing.
Mosasaurus or whatever. And they have the splash tank thing and the, you know, going underwater and then seeing the inside of the tank, which I felt was, again, kind of not really the point of this and could have skipped it, but whatever. They did it. And, meh. I did not feel wowed by that scene. One of the things that I actually kind of appreciated was when they went to the Tyrannosaurus paddock and they're inside, they're trying to get a good view of it eating the goat. And the flare is going off, which is a nice homage to the first, Jurassic Park. If they don't ruin it later with another flare for some stupid reason, which they do. But
there's a fair amount of homage in this movie. Some of it is good, some of it is not so good.
Yeah. And this is one of those ones that's good because, you know, you get the goat and they get the flare and the dinosaur's eating it. And the kids can't see it, which is actually kind of the funny part. It's like, oh, I want to see. Like, nobody can look at what's happening because everyone's crowded around the window, which I found kind of funny. And, you know, that comes up with some of the other stuff. And when they're on the monorail and then they go in little sphere things, and there's the disinterested guy who's in charge of the ride, who has to, like, man it, just like he's at Jurassic Park or Disney World or something, and he's totally not into what actually controlling what's happening. So like, there's stuff in here, like the mechanics of how the park work, that I found interesting and I actually really liked. So it's not like I completely hated the movie like I thought I was going to. And I can really appreciate this stuff and the care that I can see was put into these scenes because they really wanted to capture and poke fun at some of that theme park experience. And in a way, for these people in this world, there's a certain banality to it where it is exciting and interesting, but it is not altogether unexpected. So it's like seeing something cool at, like, the Indiana Jones ride or, like, seeing Shamu do something. Like, that's the level they're trying to put this at. And so I actually quite liked that kind of playing with expectations there.
Yeah. In the same way that they did with the brands, where they made fun of the brands and then showed the brands, they also sort of made fun of the fact that people have lost interest in dinosaurs. And then they still sort of just kind of like went along with the fact that most of them have lost interest in dinosaurs, even right up into the point where some of them are actually being eaten. So,
yeah.
While the theme was consistent and kind of worked there, in the same way that they were saying, like, you know what, they're dinosaurs, wow enough, it didn't really feel like there was a ton of awe from either the characters or moments that were built up for the audience to feel awe at the dinosaurs in this movie. Did you feel that way at all?
I was not overwhelmed by awe. I would say that I had a certain fascination with those scenes, like I'm saying, how stuff unfolded in sort of a world where this is taken to be an accepted truth. How interesting that kind of is. But that's not the same thing as awe. Like I'm not there riding along on the ride of their reaction shots, of their Spielbergian reaction shots to seeing a Brachiosaurus for the first time or something like that. Like that's not what's happening in this film.
That was the other scene that was thoroughly depressing. The dead Brachiosaurus, like, that was so drawn out and it was so depressing.
Yeah. And also kind of distracted from the urgency of the situation they were in. Let's get our characters together, shall we, and talk about how they meet up to go on their quest to go after things, like, let's say, dead Brachiosaurus. And so they meet up by Claire driving out to his Airstream trailer and makeshift home that he somehow made on this island off the coast of Costa Rica. I don't know how he made an Airstream trailer or how he got authorization to fly or ship one in, but it's there. That makes no sense to me. I don't know how he got authorization to live off the land like this. Also, doesn't make any sense to me. or how he's working on his Triumph motorcycle, which somehow also is on this island. Like, what are the requirements for shipping here? Like, this is an Amazon Prime. Like, they had to arrange for this stuff to come to this island and be set up in this spot for him, which is so strange to me that they went through that effort.
Did we get a sense of how long the park had actually been running?
I did not get an immediate sense, although they said it was several months between unveiling of different things. So I would say it's been a few years since the park's been completely open. We know that in movie time, the failure of the first park is, like, in our reality, the failure of the park in our world. However, in this film, there's also holograms. So what the f*** with that? I don't even understand. Like, did you know why? Did when you saw those holograms in the Samsung Innovation Center, where you're like, this is a great idea. I'm really glad these are here. This really helped. It's helped the whole movie. It feels so grounded with these holograms.
The Innovation Center felt definitely like a Disney or like a science center kind of thing that would be real. But the holograms were just because they could, I guess.
They didn't even stop to think, you know, if they should.
Well, they needed it later as a plot point where the flappy umbrella neck hologram pops out and distracts the raptor for a minute.
Yeah, what was it, Dilophosaurus?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, so that was not a good plot point either. So again, it's totally not worth it. I am unhappy that there were holograms in this film. I feel like that is some CSI level BS. And you know, considering that there's so many people from Law and Order in this episode, I was expecting better.
Yeah, I'm with you there. But the thing about the time scale, sure, that might lead us to understand a little bit why Chris Pratt has, like, motorcycles and Airstreams and stuff there.
No, because it wasn't the 50s when it happened. When did the Airstream trailer get there?
Well, if I recall, weren't they, like, giant Airstreams in Jurassic Park 2 that they were all doing their research out of?
No, those weren't Airstreams.
All right, fine. But anyway, it's I could see why they could have...
And it was a different island.
Yeah, I know. That was... Isla Sorna, by the way, the one with the S.
Yes. One of the five deaths.
What?
There's five islands, and they're called the Five Deaths. Scary sure. music.
Sure. Yeah. But I could see why he could have, like, a motorcycle or something. If it had been, like, years that the park's been open, and they've sort of, like... Because for the first year, you would want to keep, like, everything almost militarized. Like, people, you stay in this building. It can be locked down if anything goes horribly wrong, and we have an escape route. And like over the years, you're like, all right, we've got this sorted out. We sort of figured out where the boundaries are. We can sort of spread our wings a little bit. And like, you can have a house out on the little cliff there, and we're not super worried about something going wrong and you being eaten in your sleep. But, I didn't get the sense that the park had been open that long. So that did feel kind of weird. And the thing that really led me to not feel like the time scale was appropriate was the Indominus Rex stuff. Like, so it's that big already. Did it just grow really fast? Like you're building the walls still. And then whether it's lies or not, BD Wong is at least somewhat surprised at the abilities of the Indominus Rex. Like whether or not he knew it was going to do that, he had suspicions that it might do that, but they hadn't seen it at all up until that moment, which led me to believe that the Indominus Rex is still fairly young, but it's still gigantic. Like, so what's the life cycle of this thing like? How quickly did it grow up? And I could not figure out, like, how old it was, like, how long they had been growing it, and, like, they're just sort of getting to terms with what it can do and how big it is, but, like, it's that big and ready to go, like, it's an adult already? Like, there are a lot of little pieces in both the park and the dinosaurs that left me kind of confused.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like the geography of this film. It's whatever it needs to be for the scene you're in. Yeah, the Indominus Rex grows really fast, eats the other Indominus Rex, so maybe that's why it's twice as big as an Indominus Rex should be. Haha. No, that's not really how it works. But, you know, maybe they're just feeding it a lot of steers. It could grow quickly because of special dino DNA and other things that were thrown in, classified. And
dino growth hormones?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like there's laws against this that doesn't really bother me. Just the fact that he has this stupid little, like, macho man hut is just ludicrous to me. And
well, he's a lone wolf, man.
I never once really bought into him being a lone wolf in a theme park. I thought that was pretty ridiculous.
Well, if it's one thing you could say about people who've served in the military, they're lone wolves because they don't have to work together with other people.
Yeah, until they go on a date and he wears board shorts and she's offended. And then there's tension and then, you know, the fist thing. So moving past that scene where we established they'd gone on a date for some reason in the past.
They really should have just made him some sort of like middle of the woods crocodile hunter sort of guy. That would have been way more realistic.
I didn't like his character. I mean, I still like Chris Pratt as a person. I just don't like this character.
Well, his character, I think, was okay, but they kept trying to say things about him that just did not fit.
His character has no arc. He's completely flat.
Oh, that's for sure.
He's there's nothing that changes. He's very one-dimensional. His motives and goals are transparent to all of us in the audience. He's an honest, straight-shooting, square-jawed kind of guy. And, you know, no frills and doesn't take no gruff and whatever. Like, there's nothing to that. And so I feel like that was a pretty wasted opportunity in a film where you're spending, like, what, $200-something million? And, like, the state of Louisiana is financing part of your film. You couldn't, like, rustle up some sort of character arc for your leading man in your film?
Well, you know, he was a constant. He was the guy throughout the film who was saying, like, look, guys, you really got to listen to me. These aren't just show ponies. These are wild, intelligent animals, and you have to treat them with respect. And if you don't, bad things will happen. And then they didn't, and bad things happened. And then he said, see, I told you. And then he saved them anyway.
That was invaluable. He agrees to go see the Indominus Rex. They go see the Indominus Rex in the Indominus Rex paddock, and he makes fun of the name, and she's like, well, what would you rather have us call it? Because there's all these other ridiculous dinosaur names, and how would you think people would react to trying to pronounce this? And he's like, oh, I don't think you heard how you pronounced it. And it's just like, ugh. And then they go in, and they...
That moment was a little Star-Lordish.
Yes, well... What are you gonna do when you got a Star Lord? Gotta Star Lord it up. But the inside of the thing, and then they're like, we can't find the heat signature, and the fat incompetent guard is snacking away, and he's like, oh, he's just here. Where'd it go? And they see all the scrapes on the wall, and they're like, oh no, you don't think it climbed out? And then it's just like, oh no, where is it in the park? And it's just like, oh, the transponders are coming from inside the thing. Oh no, we let everybody inside to go try and check it out.
Like, they didn't even wait long enough to make the phone call before she drove away and they went inside. Like, wouldn't that be step one? Like, use the transponder to figure out where it is before you do anything else.
Yes. Well, when she started driving, no one in the audience knew that there was a transponder. So by the time we reacted to that, it was after that had happened.
Well, we knew there was a transponder because it was in the trailer.
Yes, well, yeah, that's true. There's a lot of stuff in that trailer. That trailer. So they go in and they have their little thing and like everybody's like, ah, and they die. And then Chris Pratt puts gasoline all over himself. And then the dinosaur wanders off. Everything goes really well. And the control center is just like, uh-oh. Well, we don't want to freak anybody out, so nobody knows what's actually happening. But let's get ACU on this, which is Animal Control Unit. Not like a Law & Order spinoff, despite all the Law & Order people in this movie.
Yeah, I thought once we did sort of gloss over how stupid everyone was with going into the cage and forgetting to check the GPS coordinates before they did all that, I did think it was a pretty well done scene of just showing how quickly things can go south if you don't like take the appropriate precautions, like, you know, the guy escaping out the door and then trying to close the door, and then of course that weakens the integrity and it just breaks right through, and then trying to hide behind the trucks, and of course everyone just starts getting eaten then there. Like, I thought that was relatively well done in terms of just like, you made one mistake, and that is just going to be a series of dominoes, and all of these people are just going to die now, because that's what happens when you don't pay attention or respect these things for half a second. This is just, this is what happens. But then when they move on to the hunting scenes, it's completely ridiculous.
Okay. Again. Well, there's also a big plot hole here, where we learn later that the Indominus Rex has the genes with which it can somehow suppress its own heat signature consciously.
And visual camouflage.
And visual camouflage, but we learn that later in the ACU scene. But in this scene, we learn that it can evade detection by the heat sensors, which they use to control and monitor it. And presumably none of them know this because B.D. Wong kept this information from them when they were building and designing this cage.
And this is the first time it decided to use them for some reason.
Yes, exactly. This is not only the first time that it used them, but that it decided to use them because it needed to be consciously done and it consciously escaped. So how it hatched this plan when, as Chris Pratt pointed out, it had only ever known the crane, then I don't know. I don't understand how that works specifically.
Well, maybe it saw that they were building the wall larger, and it was not a fan of the walls, so it did the claw marks thing to try and trick the whatever was making the wall bigger, and then decided to hide from... First of all, didn't she mention something about the Indominus Rex being able to detect heat signatures? Like, how would it know it was being monitored on infrared cameras?
It would not know.
I know there are, they say there are some animals who are able to see the light from infrared cameras, and I think that's kind of what she was getting at. So some animals do actually have that ability, but you've got like the infrared cameras, you've got like the heat detecting stuff, like all of that stuff there. It knew all of that was happening and it knew how to avoid it. Okay, sure.
Yeah, presumably, I guess you could, you know, stretch it to that, but I don't. I think that was a big plot hole. And coincidentally timed with, you know, having Chris Pratt show up.
Yeah. Well, if you watch enough Survivor Man Bigfoot, he does go on to talk about how a lot of the people think that Bigfoot is unable to be caught on infrared camera at night because it can see the infrared beams. And that's the reason it's never been caught on camera at night, not because it doesn't exist. So I think there's a similar plot point there.
Okay.
Yeah. Those Science and Travel Channel shows are fun late at night when you've got insomnia.
Okie dokie. They do that. And then...
Maybe some of the genes that they spliced into the Indominus Rex are Bigfoot genes.
Probably.
That would explain why it's classified.
Yes, because then we would have to explain Bigfoot's existence. Man, that would have been awkward for B.D. Wong. But,
That would have been a great scene if just, like... in the forest, they cut to a Bigfoot, like, poking his head around a tree and goes, like, you know what? I am not getting blamed for any of this, and just kind of, like, goes back in his cave and takes a nap.
I think that's a different kind of movie. So
I don't think it's really that different.
So they have the whole thing of the Indominus Rex going off into the woods, and they're, like, scramble ACU, and they're, like, charging packs and, like, putting on their armor and stuff, and... It's pretty ridiculous, really. They're former
Marines or something, right? Like, didn't Masrani ask them if they used to work for Special Forces or some crap?
Oh, I think that was on a later scene when they're in the helicopter, and he's one of the guys is like, "Yeah, I served in Afghanistan under General somebody."
And, well, that's the scene that almost made sense. Like, okay, so if you've got this giant thing that's loose and it started to kill people, I guess maybe you could say that they don't immediately jump to worst case scenario. Like, we should just do whatever we can to kill it. Cause right, they're trying to, they're going after it with their non-lethal stuff. But wouldn't you just want to like get in a helicopter, fly high above the tree line and do whatever you can do from there to neutralize it rather than get on the ground roaming around with wild dinosaurs?
Or spot it from the helicopter.
Sure. That's sure.
Yes.
But they've got the GPS tracker. They don't need to spot it from the helicopter.
No, especially not when the dinosaur knows how to take out the GPS tracker because it remembers when it was a child and the GPS tracker was inserted and it somehow knows that that is a GPS tracker and will you be used to track it in some way?
It's a very smart dinosaur.
There's some sort of telepathic gene that was spliced into this dinosaur, because there's no reason why it should have any motivation to do any of these things. But it does them. And so it takes out its tracker, and, you know, there's the suspenseful scene of the blood drops and, like, where is it? We can't see it. And then it's just, the camouflage comes off the dinosaur. But because that wasn't obvious enough when we saw it happen, the leader of the ACU unit needs to shout at the audience, "It can camouflage," and then he's eaten. So I thought that was absolutely ludicrous that they felt that they needed to have that line in there, because it can camouflage because we saw it camouflage. And if you need to really hit that home later, you can have that in the BD Wong scene. You don't need to have that in this scene. Having him shout that instead of shooting the thing and dying really, 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 really fast is just dumb. Like, I don't understand the point of that. But then they all get mercilessly slaughtered by this, and it makes off and does its thing. And Chris Pratt's in the control room, and he's like, "Oh, you guys are idiots. They're all going to die, blah, 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 blah.
Get them out of there.
Yeah.
Their heart rate monitors are dying, and just you can see them flatlining because for some reason they've all got heart rate monitors on."
Yeah, because aliens, that's why.
Yeah.
All of the times that we have the military guys, either the ACU guys or the engine guys going into combat, there is a distinctly aliens James Cameron vibe to that. So I encourage our viewers who, listeners, nobody's, or maybe you're just staring at your podcast app, but our listeners to go watch Aliens, and then you'll be like, oh yeah, that does seem like an overt homage to this, especially with the idiot leaders barking orders from Control Center. So the thing goes down. They all mostly die. Chris Pratt's like, "This is stupid. I'm going to get out of here. I'm not going to be a part of this, like, chicanery." And he leaves and goes down to the lobby, and then, like, all heck is breaking loose. And then she contacts Zara because she realizes that they're kids and blah, 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 what that might mean for her kids. And this is where she realizes that the nephews have gone off and that Zara doesn't know where they are, and Zara never told anybody for hours. And so she panics and she's trying to locate them and she wants to track them down and blah, 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 blah. And that she needs to get Pratt to go help because there aren't the people to spare to go get the gyroscope ball, because they won't go back, because they're like, how dangerous could this technical failure be because of Mizrani's, you know, failure to delineate the problem. And so they decide in their little gyroscope ball to go to the part in the field where there's a broken fence and go into the part where there's a broken fence. What broke the fence? And
probably a dinosaur.
Yeah, probably the evil dinosaur that we saw earlier. And why it broke the fence and then retreated back into that side where it was in, or maybe it crossed into that side from the fence part. I don't know. It didn't make a whole lot of sense. But they go in there and there's the ankylosauruses and the Indominus, and there's a big fight between the ankylosaurus and the Indominus, and it smashes up the little gyroscope ball pretty good, and they are kind of screwed. And the Indominus is pretty interested in breaking the little ball thing that they're in, for no apparent reason, because it seems like a lot of trouble to go through, since it's not something soft and squishy. And, you know, he even loses a tooth. You need that tooth for later in the film. That's probably why he lost. In his fight later, but the they go through the whole thing. They break the sphere thing. They crawl out and run away. And Indominus chases after them. And they jump down a waterfall thing. And Indominus is just like, "Screw this waterfall!" And then wanders off. But then somehow winds up where they end up going anyways later on. And they go to the visitor center, the old visitor center. They walk in. And there's the little shreds of the little tarp thing on the ground still underneath all the schmutz. They kick that aside. There's the mural where the raptor was in the first movie, and he puts his hand on it, which I don't know why you would do because the walls are obviously dirty. And then they go to the little like maintenance like room with the Jeep servicing area that was off to the side, which we didn't really see in the previous films, which is fine because we don't really need to have that as a plot point until this point in our existence. Somehow everything in this room works and has power after like at least 20 years. I don't know why that is, because those are magic batteries. Why the binoculars work, you know, put those down, they must be expensive.
The binoculars, yeah. See, this is another one of those, in case you didn't get it already, we're at the first one again. Like, when they first showed up at the old visitor center, I was like, oh my god, this is really cool. And then they go in there, and they touch the raptor on the wall, and I'm like, oh my god, that's really cool. And then they see the tarp on the ground all cut up, and I'm like, yes, this is awesome, that's really cool. And then he picks up the tarp, and he wipes the mud off the tarp, and I'm like, what are you doing? Stop, put that down. And then they make a torch out of the tarp, and I'm like, what are you doing? Stop that. And then they go in the Jeep area, and then I see the binoculars there, and I'm like, oh, son of a bitch. And then he goes to put the binoculars on. I'm like, no, stop doing that. We've got all of the nostalgia we need. And then we get to the Jeeps, and it's like, damn it! Can't you have any subtlety? Like, we got it already. Just stop.
Yeah, there was nothing subtle about it.
I went from super excited to angry.
Especially when the kid rattles off the make and model and year of the Jeep Zahara, whatever it was, 92.
1993 or well, it's 93 or whatever, right? Because that's when Jurassic Park was.
Yeah, but I thought it was a model year was 92. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's a Jeep. He knew what it was for no reason, no good reason.
But hey, remember that time we fixed Grandpa's car? Let's do that again. Which apparently the only thing that was wrong with Grandpa's car was it had a dead battery.
How they found any working battery in this shed, I don't know.
They found the working battery from the smashed little go-kart out front from somebody who got recently eaten.
Oh. When did we see that happen?
They briefly step back outside and, like, hand it over. Like, when they're going into the visitor center, there's, like, that little Can-Am, like, four-wheeler or whatever that's, like, smashed into a tree. And then they go back out and they steal it out of there because it's shiny in there.
Okay.
Yeah, it's super-duper thin, but that's what they did.
No, I remembered the smashed-up little go-kart thingy, but I didn't remember them taking it from there. I was just like, where the hell did they get a battery from? And they put it into the Jeep Sahara, and somehow the gasoline hasn't eaten through the tank, and it still works.
Hold this. You're stronger than me. And all this while, we've got this, like, brotherly bond thing that they're working on, which is just so unnecessary. Like, I guess they had to make the characters likable, but, like, why? We didn't care about their history or their futures at all.
Did you ever find them likable in this film? I did not.
I didn't have a reason to. Like, we didn't spend any time with them. Who's the main character in this movie?
Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yeah, so, like, who cares about the kids? Why are they here?
I have no idea. The kids are supposedly to serve the same function as the kids in the first movie, I would assume, except these ones are somehow not as charming.
No, they're not even remotely endearing. Like, what was his name? Tim in the first one? Like, he was kind of silly and cute. Like, he had read Dr. Grant's book, and he wouldn't shut up about it. And he was an innocent little kid.
He was annoying to the character in the film, but he wasn't annoying to us in the audience.
Right.
I felt that these guys in this film were annoying to us as the audience and not endearing to anybody in the film either. But the like the older brother, whatever his name is, he was a total creep every time he saw a woman in the park, and he was just like leering at them. It was just like, what is this supposed to be teaching anybody about this in this film? It's just like, this is not a quality that I'm really searching for in my protagonist.
Well, and then of course the little brother calls him on it, like, what's gonna happen when you're just staring at him like that?
Yeah. And then I didn't really like the little brother because I thought it was just too on the nose with the sort of like Spielbergian kid, like overachieving, like, dinosaur savant kid thing, and like is a super huge fan nerd thing, but just sort of generic about his Spielbergianness. I don't know, there's something just I didn't like about him. And they also turned out to be idiots, so that worked against them. And they got this car working. They drive off. They somehow figure out the correct direction to go on this closed road that hasn't worked in forever. Bust through a gate, turns out to be the right gate, and not like to a raptor pit. And then they go to...
That's the one where you get the guards standing on top of it, and they're like, well, you don't do that every day. And then, of course, dinosaurs...
No, it was before that. There was the old-style gate from the first movie. It was all rusted over.
Oh, yeah, just, yeah. That was also supposed to be another reference.
Yeah. They smashed into it with a car and broke through. And it's just like, well, did you really have any idea what was on the other side of this, like, at all before you did that?
It's a fence. You can see through it.
Yes. You can see more trees. And so they went through, and they start driving along. And we get the whole thing of the aviary scene now at this part. Because Claire and our intrepid hero have found themselves hot on the kid's tail, winding up the visitor center, showing up where the Jeep is. The Indominus chases after them, which I don't know what geography direction it was going in, because it was supposed to be going south, but somehow it jogged back over this way. And
how'd them clever kids even get one of these things started? Everything in here is so old. They must be super smart.
Yeah.
That's basically a line in this movie.
Basically, that's exactly it. And the Indominus, you know, is all like, oh no, he's going to get him. We better hide on the other side of this car. Ah, he's breathing. Oh no. And it's like, oh, we got the gun. We're safe now. Ah, I broke in through the ceiling, because the ceiling's made out of paper mache. And then of course, like you're saying, they don't know when to stop with the homage in this film. And so immediately they spring into the biggest homage of them all. And they have the characters sprint back through the lobby of the visitor center, where the Indominus breaks through some more walls, winds up in the central foyer, and just goes roar, just like the Tyrannosaurus Rex in the first film when it does that in the first movie. And so it's just like, you guys, knock it off. Like, that's stupid. It doesn't like, I'm not feeling fondly about that moment, because it's so forced that it doesn't feel like I need to have that happen, and yet it did. And so that happens. They get through and they're like, oh, we spotted it, blah 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 blah, control center. And this is where they like hoof it over to wherever, and they're like, oh yeah, control center, we spotted it, blah 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 blah, it's over here, we've got eyes on it, and we're gonna send the helicopter over. And they send the helicopter over with Mr. Masrani, and Lauren Lapkus is like, are you sure you should be doing this? Your pilot guy is nowhere to be found. He's like, nope, I'm totally on the ball on this one. And this is when you knew he was gonna die. And we glossed over another stupid scene with him. So Irfan Khan also has a scene with B.D. Wong where they're talking about the makeup of the dinosaurs, and B.D. Wong's like, it's classified. Again,
which makes us wonder, who does B.D. Wong actually work for?
I don't know. Because like I was saying, the structure of this company makes no sense to me. Because he theoretically should be reporting to him about what's inside of the dinosaur. And so he's just like, oh, yeah, we just put in cuttlefish stuff because blah, 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 BS reason. And we did whatever it was, African tree frog or whatever. Something like that. Yeah, yeah, for blah, blah, blah reason. He's like, you know, nothing in here is like a pure creature. Like, everything has like supplemental DNA in order to make it work. You know, nothing really looks like a real dinosaur, which is, of course, on the nose about why they don't have like feathers and stuff, which is something that... you know, archaeologists kind of suspected after the film was released, and blah, 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 whatever.
Yeah, there was some good stuff in this scene where they're basically saying, like, look, man, this is not what they look like. This is not the right color. You wanted them bigger. You wanted more teeth. Like, it's getting down to the root of what this movie is about, where it's like, yes, this is about the awe of dinosaurs, but at the end of the day, this is a commercial venture, and you tasked me with making the biggest, scariest things that I could, and that's what I did, and that's my job. And clearly he went astray, and he's off the path a little bit, especially because he's somehow allied with Vincent D'Onofrio. But like, this is supposed to be the clash between the idealistic Masrani, who's running the place, and the scientist who's, who's gone all nuts with what he could instead of what he should or whatever. But this whole scene just felt kind of like, here's some explanation, which is going to end up being more important than like the actual theme of the movie. It's like the theme was completely buried underneath the fact that like, oh, he gave away the hint there. Like they put extra stuff in there because they were trying to militarize it or whatever. And that's why it's got all these special features now.
Yeah. Well, it was immediately abundantly clear to me that BD Wong did this and it was all lying that he was giving to Irfan Khan here.
Was it the fingerprint scanner on the door that gave it away?
A little bit.
And that sort of like awkward look around the office every time he locked his office?
Yeah, and also BD Wong's, shall we say, over-the-top delivery of his defense of his actions.
He doesn't really get to go that high in SVU because he's sort of a mellow therapist. So he's stretching himself.
Yes, well, this is Law & Order JW or Law & Order ACU. So... He can do whatever he wants. Dr. Huang,
We should recut this with, like, the Law & Order sounds, like the little title card saying where each scene takes place.
Yeah, the bum-bum. But the... God, that'd be so stupid.
Jurassic World Visitor Center.
I bet there are enough clips of Dr. Huang from Law & Order SVU that you could use to, like, cut in... to have him interrogate himself in this scene. That would be pretty fun.
Either that or like him explaining like the complex that Vincent D'Onofrio or Bryce Dallas Howard had and led them to their downfall in this movie.
Yeah. Well, Jesus. Anyway, the helicopter thing. He goes and they've got the machine gun mounted to the helicopter now, which he said he wasn't going to do before, but now it seems somewhat more serious than it did before. They take off and you're like, yes, you're all gonna die.
Also, I questioned, like, I think it was Chris Pratt, he's like, you guys have a such and such gun, get up in a helicopter and just kill this thing. And
yeah, his words were smoke it. Right. I believe. Yeah.
You understand that, like, maybe that they would have a contingency plan. Like, all right, if something goes horribly wrong, we're going to literally have to kill a dinosaur. We need a really big freaking gun for that sort of thing. And while this is not exactly a small gun, this is not the kind of thing that I would immediately assume would kill a dinosaur. Like, why did they not have, like, artillery-sized weaponry that they could take out a dinosaur with? They seem, again, this is their, like, last line of defense. Like, did you guys even think this through?
Well, they're, no, because this is a Jurassic Park movie. Obvious thing would have been to, like, put in some sort of, like, cyanide pouch or something. there's no reason why we should get to this point. And you know, there's the whole thing of like, it somehow knew how to claw out its beacon. So maybe it would have clawed out a cyanide patch or whatever. But
you haven't seen Kingsman yet, have you?
No, I haven't.
You should go see that.
Okay. Well, anyway, you could have killed them. Like it didn't make any sense. And there was also the whole thing of like, oh, it'll get near enough to an invisible fence and then it'll turn around. Cause the beacon will electrically shock it. And you're just like, really? It will. Like, did you test this? I don't feel like you tested this. Because they really should have probably had something where it would have just, like, shocked the animal dead with the flip of a switch or, like, knocked it out or something. But they didn't have any of that stuff. It was pretty ridiculous. And so they have the machine gun thing, and they mount it on the thing, and they go chasing after it, and they're, like, shooting at it through the trees. And because they're on a helicopter and the guy's shooting... he's shooting like 2 feet behind it the whole entire time. It runs into the aviary. It squawks at all the birds and all the dino birds and all the pterodactyls and whatever those other things were.
The things that looked like pterodactyls with a T-Rex head.
Yeah. And like the long tails, those ones, the little dragon ones.
Those were very odd.
Yeah. I don't know what was up with that. I don't know what that is, but it was basically those two different kinds. And so they're all like panicked and freaking out because it's just like, hey, there's this thing that came in here and scaring the crap out of us. And unfortunately, the dome breaks and the birds go out and the birds go hit the helicopter and knock it a little off kilter, and like somebody gets stabbed in the front, and the guy falls out of it who's doing the gun stuff, and then the thing, you know, goes spiraling out of control and smashes into the side of the aviary, kills Mr. Mizrani, blows up a big hole in the thing. All of the pterodactyls and everything escape from the aviary and immediately go flocking towards the Innovation Center. And like, for lack of a better term, City Walk, or whatever you want to call it, in Margaritaville. And then we get the Siege of Margaritaville. And somehow, between seeing this on the edge of a cliff and like 2 seconds later, the kids have arrived at the gate and they're like, please let us in, please let us in. We're being chased by these bird things. The guys are like, what? Didn't think you'd see that. And they let him in because they see the birds. And then somehow Bryce Dallas Howard and Chris Pratt get back there in like 2 seconds. No Jeep like rejiggered or anything. They got back there in like 2 seconds, like a hot minute. They're back there. They go in through like a different gate, so they don't rendezvous with the kids yet. But they're like, oh no, there's all this crap happening. Everybody needs to take shelter, and it's just complete chaos and bedlam. Jimmy Buffett has his cameo where he saves two margaritas, and runs off screen with them.
You know, I had heard that was him, and then I saw it, and I'm like, how would anyone know? It's just a blurry human being holding two glasses.
Yes. I'm right there with you. I only know that because someone told me.
Like, who cares?
No one. I'm sure Jimmy Buffett does. I'm sure Jimmy Buffett was like, yeah, this is a free trip to Louisiana.
He's gonna go watch the movie with all his friends and family and be like, yeah, here comes my cameo. And there it was. You see me? It was me. I ran through there. Like, what? Holding the margarita? Why would you agree to be in this movie just to do that?
I don't know. Margaritas?
Brands.
Yep, well, it happened. And they have the panic and the bedlam and the birds are all flying around. Again, there's no control here. That's just like, hey, all of our flying creatures that can attack people have escaped. Maybe throw the little switch that knocks them out. Oh, wait, we don't have one. Why not?
Well, they threw the switch that set the automated voice off saying, hey, everybody, please slowly move towards the exits.
It was take shelter or something, I think.
It wasn't even the one that, like, there was a later message that said, like, please get indoors. Like, this is the one that was just like, due to a security malfunction.
Security anomaly.
Yeah, that's great transparency right there. A security anomaly.
Anomaly is always a good word. It was stupid. And again, stupid policy, because anything could have cracked that dome. A hurricane, an accident, like anything could have cracked that dome and these things would have been flying out of there, ripping up people. So why was there absolutely nothing to safeguard against that? And ACU couldn't have done anything about it either, because ACU only has non-lethal weapons or a couple shotguns and then that machine gun, which wouldn't really have done anything against a bunch of flying bird things. So I don't know what their security plan was here. This park was stupid. This is like, it's by the time you get to this part in the movie where you're like, oh, this is Jaws 3 I'm watching, not Jaws. This is the underwater SeaWorld park and everything's gone to crap. Have you ever seen Jaws 3?
I don't think I have.
Oh, Dan, you should have like a whole bottle of bourbon and watch that one. That one, Michael Caine's in it. I think he said he did it because it paid for a kitchen or something. But that is not a good film, and it is also similarly along these sorts of lines where there's a theme park and things go wrong, and they think they can control the creature, but they can't control the creature. Just in case you ever thought that there was an original idea that this movie had, it does not have them. But the
you know, I'm just trying to think through the other things that are like either not original ideas or just in line with the other ones. Like, this movie ostensibly takes place over the course of one day. Like, there's the daytime stuff where everything is hunky-dory, and then by the time we get to night, everything is a giant pile of one big pile of poo, as Goldblum would say. But, like, just everything about this just is so compressed and poorly thought out, especially by the time we get to the third act, like you're saying here. Like, basically at this point, they've just thrown all this stuff into the stew, and it's just like, what would happen? People would be running around, being killed. And then they would have to figure out a way to kill the big dinosaur. So how would we do that?
Yeah, well, this is where Vincent D'Onofrio has a plan, and he takes charge. And you know, be wary of anybody who was ever on Law and Order Criminal Intent. That includes Jeff Goldblum, which I think would have been kind of funny if Jeff Goldblum came back and fought Vincent D'Onofrio, because they were both on Criminal Intent. But
you know, the best thing they could have done is cut to Jeff Goldblum watching like a news feed where they're like reporting on the story of everything going wrong, and just have him sort of like chuckle and change the channel to like Law and Order.
Oh man, that would have been a little too tongue in cheek. But so anyway, Vincent D'Onofrio takes charge, and like all 1980s villains, has his own guys come in and take over and run the show.
Above your pay grade, bro. You've been relieved of duty.
Yes. I'm glad you asked. You're relieved of duty. And they have, you know, their gray mat plastic lunch boxes that they bring in, and they take over.
Because they needed to bring in their own equipment, too.
I don't understand the dynamic of this. Like, were they reading up on, like, how to operate a theme park, like, in their spare time or something? Like, under what conditions were these security forces trained for this? Like, this doesn't make any sense. But they you know, they come in and they do the 1980s thing of taking over and blah, blah,
no,
blah.
No, man, it's they're the Illuminati. They've been there the whole time, sort of as the understudy or the overstudy, I guess, whatever you want to say. Like, they've always been looming just above you in the shadows, watching what you're doing. And then just whenever they need to, they can just push you out of the way and just jump in.
Okay, Dan Brown. But so that worked out well. But so the thing is a little silly, because especially when Jake gets off to the side and he's like in some like glass room or something off to the back, so you can kind of see stuff over his shoulder, and he's like, "We got relieved duty. Things are really bad. You better not come up here, Claire. There's stuff happening."
Yeah, and even then, tactically, like, if Vincent D'Onofrio wanted to be the bad guy, so he like comes in and he relieves them all of duty, like, you don't let those guys just like run off on their own. You're supposed to detain them so they don't cause trouble for your plan, if you really are this guy who's gonna step in and take over. Like, he just lets Jake walk over to the corner and pick up a phone and be like, "Hey, they're doing bad stuff."
Yeah, well, not only that, but then he leaves them in the control room the whole rest of the movie. He doesn't send them anywhere. They just stay there. But he has, like, I don't know, maybe it was a bathroom break, and there's a clear bathroom in the background, and he walked into that. but you know, he makes that call, and Claire's like, "Oh no, this is bad news. He's taking over, and he's going to do his plan." And then Chris Pratt's like, "Oh no, this means he's going to do his raptor plan." Like, because obviously. And Omar Sy, who had previously only seen the engine guys coming on shore and couldn't contact anyone for several hours, apparently, he's brought back into this at this point, when Vincent D'Onofrio is like, "Yeah, we're gonna go through the and do the raptor plan and
field
like,
test,
yeah, either you're with us on this field test or you're not with us on this field test, and like, stuff's gonna go down or stuff's not gonna go down, and things are gonna happen or things not gonna happen, and we're gonna do stuff or not do stuff." Like, it was so ridiculous. And so,
"I would like to pet your raptors. He's growling at you because he wants to eat you. That's good. We should let him loose now."
Yes. It was so ridiculous. Like, we put some cameras on him. Get good. You can see yourself get eaten. All the better to see you with, my dear.
Why? Why did they put cameras on them? They already have their GPS chips. Why cameras?
Because, I don't know, they want to...
Is this what the militarization of raptors looks like? Like, I genuinely don't know. Is it because, like, soldiers have to wear their, like, their packs so they have all their gear? Like, is this what, like, a militarized raptor would look like in the field? It's got its camera on and, like, its headset or whatever?
Well, it's in case there's a problem. They want to have that for the insurance companies.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Just like in Russia, everyone's required to have one.
Yeah, well, actually, I think you wouldn't want to have them in that case, because they're most likely going to have a problem because they're going to eat everybody. But so anyway,
yeah, if you catch it on camera, it becomes evidence pretty much immediately.
Yes. So they do this whole thing, and then Chris Pratt's like, "No, you can't do it. Punch." And
and then they have a polite conversation, and Chris Pratt's like, "Oh, maybe you're right."
And well, he's like, oh, well, I'd rather be here if you're going to let him out than not be here if you're going to let him out. And, you know, and it's like the most, like, tenuous little leap of logic there. I was just like, yes, this is why you have to do this, Chris Pratt. You have to do this. There's no other way.
Your
hands were forced into this.
I know it's not in the movie, the line from the trailer, we do this, we do it my way, but he basically says, we do this, we do it my way, because he takes over the mission and becomes the first in command. He's the alpha of the pack, and he calms them down. He gives them their little stare and pets them and stuff and says, like, here's what we're going to go do. Sniff the Indominus Rex chunk of meat, and we're going to go kill it. And apparently they can sniff it because it's like a scent game or whatever, something he did as part of their training with them. And they're going to go track down the scent. But it's only when they get to of course, I'm glossing over motorcycle gang with raptors because
you're totally glossing over the motorcycle gang with raptors.
They smell the chunk of Indominus Rex. They go off running. Chris Pratt jumps on his motorcycle and they jump in their cars and they're all riding together. They're going to chase down the Indominus Rex and, you know, motorcycle gang of raptors. But like smelling it, they didn't know what they were searching for. They just knew it had this smell. But then when they find it, we get dun dun dun. Yet another thing we didn't expect.
I expected it.
The Indominus Rex is part raptor and starts talking to them and it's like, oh, hey, guys, didn't see you there. You should be on my side and eat those humans because reasons. I don't know, because he's just like, hey, I'm new here and I feel like killing everything. And we're similar. We speak the same language, so you should be on my side. Like, I know that guy's been training you and he's the head of your pack, but we can talk to each other. So that means I supersede him. So go kill humans.
I saw this twist coming. Not from like the beginning of the movie or anything, but I saw this twist coming when we got our first good look at the Indominus Rex and they talked about how its DNA was classified. And it was just like, well, it's got a slender little mouth area part thing, and it's kind of got sort of raptor proportions a little bit more than T-Rex proportions, obviously, because it has arms. It's have tiny little arms and a big head. But so the dinosaur has some similarities. And so it was just like, you know, probably part raptor. And then, of course, like in Jurassic Park 3, all you have to do is speak a little raptor, and then you got a raptor on your pinky. And so...
You think I can get a raptor on Rosetta Stone?
Yeah, there's Duolingo for raptor. Mm. Yeah.
You know, I honestly thought, like, the twist of the Indominus being part raptor, I thought that was okay. Like, that sort of explained some of its aggressive tendencies, and, you know, sort of like why it was doing some of the things different than you might have expected with a T-Rex. But, what they did with that, twist was just terrible.
Malarkey. So the twist happens and they all panic. And, again, all heck breaks loose. The guns are firing. There's total chaos. And this is one of the first in a line of scenes where I can't keep track of the number of raptors who are actually in play because of how it's shot and edited. Sometimes it's like, so is one of them knocked out? Did one of them die? Did two of them die? Are three of them okay? Like, what's happening? Like, I know there's four total, or there were four total. Like, what are we dealing with here in terms of the operative number of raptors? Who is being attacked by these? Which ones are the same ones?
I think one immediately died, and then two of them were, like, knocked out, but then get back in the game.
Yeah.
So I think there's three that are there, and they're fighting the humans, and then, like, Chris Pratt gives them, like, a stare down and gives them, like a... bro, we're bros, look. And then he's like, you know what, bro, we are bros, and I'm gonna go attack the Indominus because he's messing with my bros. And the raptors turn back again and they start fighting the Indominus, pretty ineffective.
That happens so much later in the film.
Much later. It's just a mess of terrible fighting at this point.
Yeah, so there's this mess, and there's of course another aliens thing, like the heartbeats and blah blah blah. Control center, oh no, this didn't work how I thought it would. And Vincent D'Onofrio is like, aw shucks, so much for my plan. And so Omar hides in a log, and you know, Chris Pratt lures away that raptor with his motorcycle, and, you know, then the kids, you know, have to deal with the raptors going into the, trying to get into the van. And then they go off on their little thing, and they get back to the city part area thing. Although they left Omar out there by himself. So sorry, Omar. And they get back to the city part of city walk area. Almost all the people have been evacuated to boats, so it's just them. They go into the innovation center, which might arguably not seem like a safe place, but they're like, we'll go to the control room, which every time they show the control room, it's like embedded in the side of a hill, but somehow you get to it through the innovation center. I don't know how
probably,
that works.
There's probably a funicular at the back that you can take up the hill.
Yes. The Jurassic funicular. So funicular park, it's their little lesser known ride. They started out with that one, you know? And so
I think that's a Meryl Streep movie, funicular park.
Oh God. So they get through the part of the lab, and then she's all like, hey, wait a minute. This secret door is open. I hear things. We should totally go in there. And, they go into the secret lab. And they, even though they heard stuff, it was apparently from the back of the secret lab, and nobody heard them coming in and talking. And so they're like looking at the tanks, and they see weird stuff. And then
spinal columns and jars of water with electrodes attached to them.
Yeah, and then and like the like lizard skink things and stuff. And then
oh yeah, I loved all those ridiculous close-up shots looking through like the snake tank where the kids are looking at them like, ooh, look, little animals. It's like, wait, these must be what's all in the big scary dinosaur.
Yeah, well, then Vincent D'Onofrio is like, I'm going to explain my evil plan now. And then you're like, okay, so Vincent D'Onofrio is definitely gonna die. And
I did like how he's like basically like right in the middle of a sentence when the raptor just pops in and is like, nope, you're done.
Well, the thing I like about the raptor is when he has that oh shit moment, and he, like when he's monologuing, and then he's like, oh, I'm going to talk it down. I'm going to reason with it. And then, of course, it eats his arm. Now, we didn't actually see him get entirely consumed, so maybe there'll be a armless, mostly wounded version of Vincent D'Onofrio in the sequel, and undoubtedly there will be a sequel.
I stayed until after the credits. I didn't see an armless Vincent D'Onofrio.
No, well, nobody wants to see that. But you got to work the armless Vincent D'Onofrio you have, not the armless Vincent D'Onofrio you want. And then they get out of there, and they're like, we should go back to the control room. Another raptor shows up. They're like, nope, not that way. Back through the innovation center. Turn on the hologram. Again, stupid, stupid hologram. They get back to the city walk area. They're confronted by all the raptors now, and instead of attacking, all the raptors just hover around them, just like in Jurassic Park 3. And so then the Indominus comes in, and it's all like, rawr, 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 rawr. And then the raptors are all like, rawr, 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 rawr. Like, I don't want to hurt him. And then
you can almost tell the words that are just like, very good, you've got them cornered, now finish them. But do we have to? He's nice to us. He's one of the good ones. I said, finish him, you fool. Obey me or I will destroy you. It's like, okay.
And then he knocked him into a Starbucks. And if there's anything we know that dinosaurs don't like, it's being knocked into a Starbucks. So the other two sick themselves onto the Indominus, which is futile. And there's a bunch of scrambling around, and they all like hide in a gift shop. And there's battles ensuing, and one of the raptors gets thrown through like some sort of like flame cookery thing and burns up in a ball of fire. The other raptor is killed, and they're like, we need more teeth. And this is incredibly stupid. This is like this is the amber that broke the Dilophosaurus's back. She's like, yeah, we opened paddock 9, and I'm like, nope, T-Rex is in there. And like Jason next to me was like, what's in paddock 9? And I was like, T-Rex, totally T-Rex, 100% T-Rex. I know exactly what they're gonna do. They're gonna open it up, because they want to have a T-Rex versus Indominus Rex fight. Because we barely saw the T-Rex in this movie, and you can't have a Jurassic Park movie without having a T-Rex in it. And if there's anything they want to do more than anything else, it's have two dinosaurs duke it out, just like they did in previous films. And so, here we go. We open Paddock 9. And there's, she lights up the flare, again, another homage to the first film. And the we see the light reflect off of the T-Rex's eyes before we see him come lumbering out and, or I'm sorry, her come lumbering out, because remember, they're all female. The T-Rex is somehow totally going along with this plan, and not like, I don't really care about her, I'm going to make a break for it. It's like, I'm just going to follow this bright thing.
The T-Rex is like one of the only dinosaurs that kind of acts like the T-Rexes of the previous movies, where it's just kind of like a wild animal. And while you may have seen this coming, I honestly didn't feel like this part was the dumbest thing that they could have done. Like, I felt like this was kind of an okay thing to do. Like, if you're at your wit's end and you're about to be eaten by this thing, like, go for broke and sick an equally large dinosaur on it. Like, maybe the flare was a little much, but maybe that's just like in the best practices handbook. Like, they learned from all of the various movies. Like, if you need to get a T-Rex's attention, a flare is a pretty good way to do it. So she, I don't know where she got the flare, but she had a flare. So, you know, if you got a flare, use a flare.
Yeah. Well, you put a flare on the shelf in the last act and then just have it there.
It's more like you put a, what's the water dinosaur called?
Mosasaurus.
Yeah, put a Mosasaurus on the mantle in the first act.
Yeah.
Because they basically did the callback. Because it wasn't it in the lady explaining in the Mosasaurus demo, like, it would eat sort of anything that was either in the water or near the shoreline or whatever it could get its teeth on. And it's like, oh, really? Anything remotely near the waterline it eats, you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so another reason why... Oh, and I think she actually got the flare from the gift shop when she got it from, like, the first aid kit or something. But,
because I know that I keep flares in all of my first aid kits. That's a good place to keep.
Well, I mean, it's Jurassic Park. I mean, Jurassic World, you want to keep them everywhere.
Actually, you know what? If they learned anything from the first movie, it would be, like, always have a flare nearby.
Always be flaring. But, so the T-Rex follows her in a slow, lumbering trot. And it's just like, oh, what is this? An Indominus Rex, which I've never seen before. I shall attack it. I'm totally giving up on the actual, like, flare person thing. And it starts attacking the Indominus Rex, and then the raptor is still attacking, and then the raptor is, like, jumping up on top of the back of the T-Rex and crossing over to the Indominus, and then, like, biting, and going back and forth. And this scene goes on forever. The scoring by Michael Giacchino here is just awful, because it's just, like, sort of like a throbbing, noisy thing from, like, an interstitial part of one of his Star Trek scores. I did not find it impressive at all for two kings of, you know, the dinosaurs to be fighting. But this happened, or queens of the dinosaurs, I guess. Queens of the Dinosaur Age. Different cover band. But so they go at it, and they do this thing. And when they start getting close to the water, like you're saying, it's like, yep, Mosasaurus. And Mosasaurus comes up, bites it, takes it under the water. The scarred up T-Rex is like, you know, this was all worth it just for the experience alone. I'm not going to eat anyone. I'm going to wander off into the jungle now.
Yeah, this is I take back what I said about the T-Rex. This is the part where it no longer acts the way it did in the first movies. Like, it starts off that way, and you can kind of see what they did in the first Jurassic Park, where it was like, you know, it was wandering around, it heard something going on in Jurassic Park 1, it found its way into the visitor center, and it found some prey, and it was going to go after it, and then the raptors were all like, no, this is mine. He's like, you know what, I'm bigger than you, I'm going to kill you, and then I'm going to assert my dominance. In this one, he just rolls up, and he's like, sup, buddy? What's going on, Mr. Indominus? Let's fight to the death. Like, if he would have walked in and, like, seen the people or something, and the Indominus would have lashed out at him first, like, you know, because apparently he's feral, because he's been kept in a cage. Then he could have been like, hey, what are you doing? This is my turf. But it was really just like, I'm here now. Let's team up with the raptor and kill this thing because, he's big and I have an inferiority complex and I'm going to kill it. But like the raptor and the T-Rex teaming up was a little bit much, even if maybe that was kind of cool for a little bit. But, just the way they got into it so quickly over no purpose, it didn't feel like there was a, like an animalistic motivation to it, where they were just like going after the same prey, and you know, the way animals could sort of fight over stuff like that. It was just like, oh hey, I'm here now. Let's fight.
Yeah, let's do this.
And then afterward, like the way that it sort of like gave like a head nod to the raptor, like good game, and then walked away, even though it was all clawed up. That was terrible.
Yeah, well,
like you don't imagine at the end of Jurassic Park 1, after it defeats the raptors and it does its like screamy thing and the banner falls down, you don't imagine he was just like, yeah, and walks away. You imagine he like ate a raptor or something. He's like, yeah, I'm king of the hill. This is what I'm here to do. At the end of this one, he's just like, that's all I do. I'm a dinosaur. I'm here to kill the dinosaurs, and I'm going to go back to my paddock and lay down and take a nap now or something. Like, what is he doing other than like killing for food or like, you know, to hunt or something? Like, what's the point? Why is he just going to leave now?
Well, at least he didn't go rawr, 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 and then the raptor went rawr, 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 because that would have also been bad. But they, you know, I think it is completely ridiculous. The T-Rex, she wanders off, all glistening with blood, totally not killed anything, not eaten anything, didn't get what she wanted. And the raptor...
Full of goat from earlier.
Just so full of goat. Chevre. So the raptor is all like, yeah, so I'm going to go now. Because it also does not feel compelled to pursue anything for whatever reason. And so it's like, I am a noble creature of the jungle now. Goodbye, fellow human.
And I love how he runs straight down Main Street, and then he gets to the end there, and he's like, ooh, look over here, like hot pretzels. I'm going to go this way, and turns left.
Yes, well, a wrong turn to Albuquerque. Wrong turn to the Samsung Innovation Center. and so they're like, okay, Jake, you can turn off everything now, and we can all go to the boat. So again, stupid. And
they just got to get off the island and then nuke it from orbit to make sure.
Well, I'm pretty sure they're not doing that one, because this thing made a gajillion dollars. Nobody's nuking anything. So they go through this whole rigmarole. They get off the island. They're in some hangar in Costa Rica, and they all get reunited. And for a hot minute, Claire and Karen are like, yeah, so sorry about that with the kids. And she's like, I'm just happy they're okay. And like, they hug. And then
she should have been like, how'd your divorce go?
Yeah, God. Well, see, because it wasn't resolved. It meant nothing in this film. And so they, like, we don't find out if they did get divorced. We don't find out, like, you know, because the reality of the situation be, oh yeah, we still got divorced anyways. We still love you. We came here because we love you so much, and we're going to rescue you together. But we're still totally divorced, because the thing you don't know is your dad cheated. Or, you know, it's like that it was just like, I don't know why that wasn't here. I mean, maybe they shot something and they cut it out of the film, but it was not in... We had no resolution to why they had this other story thread that was in there for no reason. And the whole thing happens here where they're like, oh, well... Chris Pratt, where does that leave us? And it's like, ugh, God, Jesus Christ. Now they're together, and
gotta stay, like, together for survival reasons.
Yes, yes. LOL. And then we cut back to the island, and up to the helipad, which is on top of the command center, which is deserted now. And the T-Rex goes up there, and it's just like, roar! I am T-Rex, and that's the end of the film. Oh, and B.D. Wong escaped on that helicopter earlier with all of the embryo research stuff. So, I don't know. Maybe the next movie will be all about B.D. Wong's island. The island of B.D. Wong. Full of his genetic creations. Who knows what it'll be about. But
well, it's going to be all about the militarized dinosaurs, because they said the park was, you know, there's no way that they would recover from this. They were trying to contain it, but there's no way they could recover from an incident like this. So the park is kaput. They're going to have to find some other use for these dinosaur embryos.
Yeah, well, that's what they said the last time the park was kaput.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The accountants are going to be pretty bummed.
Yeah. Well, all you need is another person who thinks there's a good investment opportunity, and then you're saved.
Another rich, idealistic billionaire.
Mm-hmm. And then you can come in and you can have Jurassic Universe or Jurassic Galaxy. And
the Jurassic Galaxy.
Yeah. And then Chris Pratt can come back and he could be Guardians of Jurassic Galaxy.
I might be interested to see that one instead of this one.
Oh, goodness gracious. So is there anything else, a stone unturned as it were, in this, or do you think we've summarily beaten this dinosaur to its skeletal fossilized remains?
You know, the thing about the Jurassic Park movies is it's all sort of, each one of them starts off sort of like, here's a small thread of what we were going to do, and it kind of involves dinosaurs. And then at some part, one or two things goes horribly wrong, and it just snowballs from there. And then the rest of the movie is just an attempt to survive and escape. And, you know, that's kind of just the format. That's kind of the way it has to go. And this one does that. It just does a lot of other weird stuff, too. Like, all of the brand stuff, all of the military stuff, all of the theme park stuff. It's just, it's not even like tongue in cheek. It's just kind of like there, and it's kind of satirical almost, but not really. And it's just kind of, it's just there. It's something else in this movie to kind of go like, all right, I see what you're doing there, but it doesn't really make it any different, because we know something bad is going to have to happen, and it's going to be everybody trying to survive. But if you want to set it up with military stuff, or you want to set it up with brand stuff, whatever you wanted to do, like, that's fine, I guess. But when it comes down to it, it's going to be some characters that we hopefully give a crap about trying to survive while dinosaurs try to kill them. And it seems like they kind of shortchanged the dinosaurs part, and they put a lot more brands and park in this one.
Well, like I said, I don't have any objection to the tongue-in-cheek stuff, except for the fact that they went on to do what they were tongue-in-cheek joking about. So the jokes about wow factor, the jokes about the references to the previous parks, the we've got it all under control now, the hubris of all of that stuff, that's all fine. The fact that they go on to have these other ridiculous moments in this film where the film itself, not the park, but the film outside of that, the construct that is actually the narrative vehicle here, where that is taking this seriously once more, then it's just like, well, then you failed, because you're not really making a tongue-in-cheek joke. You're making a tongue-in-cheek joke so that way you know you can get away with doing the thing you're joking about, which is, of course, the T-Rex and Dominus Rex battle and the, you know, the all that crazy over-the-topness. And so that I take issue with. And, of course, the you know, people have brought up the sexism that's inside this movie of, like, how Claire doesn't want to have kids or want to be around kids, and how she's a businesswoman, and how she has to kind of put her businesswoman self on the side, and she has to, like, open herself up to the possibility of other people and caring for other people and, like, get in touch with her sort of maternal side. And, you know, there's a way in which that mirrors Dr. Grant in the first movie, where he has to go on this voyage of not liking kids and not wanting to be around kids, but he's a man, so it is a slightly different take on that story than this.
Yeah, but it almost didn't seem like Claire knew anything about or cared about dinosaurs. She was just like, I'm here to run a company or a theme park or whatever. So it was just kind of like, I run a company for the sake of running a company. It wasn't like an idealistic, like, I'm putting my personal life on hold to pursue this thing that I love.
Yeah, I don't know. We also found out so little about Claire. We didn't really find out much about what makes her tick, other than she was totally down for running through the forest in high heels, which apparently Bryce Dallas Howard did on purpose. She trained to run in those heels. Like, those aren't computer-generated heels. She ran in those. It seems ill-advised.
I noticed that right when she was letting the T-Rex out. I'm like, oh, she's still in heels, and they haven't broken off. Okay.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't understand why that was a necessary thing, but she felt it was necessary as an actress, and they did it. I feel like she should have just ditched them. And you look at Laura Dern in the first movie, and like her character and her character's sort of strong, maternal, but still, she has some maternal instincts and wants to have kids and likes the idea of kids, but she has she's very much in touch with being a feminist and like of being in charge of herself and taking risks and protecting those around her in a certain way. And like when, you know, Hammond is like, I'm going to go to the shelter thing. And she's like, you know, don't be ridiculous. We can have a conversation about feminism when I get back. You know, and she goes off with trudges off with a Muldoon over to the shed.
Dinosaur kills man, woman inherits the earth. All
yes.
That stuff.
Yes, yes. And so I found her to be a far more compelling female character in this franchise, which is, of course, is, than I would say other characters in this film franchise have been. In the last one, you know, Taya Leone is just kind of divorced and kind of shrill, and it's not great for her. I think she's a pretty good actress, so I don't really find that to be a flattering character for her to be portraying, and doesn't have a lot of range. And then, of course, you have to deal with the crazy screwball accent of Julianne Moore. So Julianne Moore has a certain strength to her, or whatever. But I mean, I didn't find her to be great or anything. But you know, compared to Claire, who I don't think makes a lot of really wise decisions. She's the one with the arc, and she's the one who changes over the whole thing, and I feel pretty disappointed about it, really. My favorite characters are, of course, Lauren Lapkus and Jake Johnson, especially when they have their little moments about, you know, going to kiss and, like, the big dramatic hero moment, and then, of course, Lauren Lapkus says, "Oh, I have a boyfriend," and he's like, "Oh, you didn't really talk about him. I didn't know that you." And she's like, "Oh, well, I just didn't really want to bring it up." And, you know, at the workplace, and like they have their little like improv moment. And it turns out it was improv. I listened to the episode of The Nerdist with Lauren Lapkus on it, and she was discussing how, you know, originally their characters were supposed to just kiss right then, and that was supposed to be it. And I find that it was far more interesting, and I like laughed my butt off when I was in the movie theater and that happened, because I found it to be such an unexpected twist. So I wish there had been more unexpected twists and less of the tongue in cheek, and then we still go ahead and do it anyway stuff. That was nice. The last thing to say about this probably is the, fact that this is, you know, an insane blockbuster tentpole release that totally defies the logic that I would have assumed would have, like, I thought that this would do well enough. I did not think that this was going to do better than everything in the whole entire universe, ever in the history of cinema, which it apparently has done. So that was a total shocker. Did that take you by surprise?
200 million opening weekend.
Yeah, that is bonkers. Bigger than Avengers.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like every tentpole these days is bigger than the previous tentpole. I didn't quite expect it to be this popular either, but I guess, you know, I see some merits. It's kind of entertaining. There's dinosaurs. Why wouldn't you want to go see that when you've been inundated with nothing but space superheroes for years? So it's kind of a little bit of relief from that. Plus everyone still has warm fuzzies from Jurassic Park, so why not? I mean, I think that gets a lot of people in the door just because it's a Jurassic Park movie. But no, I wouldn't have expected this much money already, but that's, I mean, good for it, I guess.
Yay.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you think about it. Coming back to, there was the other Nerdist interview with Chris Pratt and the director, who he's talking about basically the premise of the movie is how humans will always kind of screw the pooch when money is on the line. And there's a buck to be made, they will kind of forget their place and do some things wrong, and they'll all end up dying. And I guess that's an interesting theme to a point. I'm not sure that that's as interesting a point as the one that was made in the first Jurassic Park, which is why that one is still so beloved. I don't know. It still feels like a more tasteful movie, just the way the dinosaurs and the theme of the dinosaurs were treated and respected. But what do I know? A lot of people like the movie, and I'm glad that people are seeing movies, but, you know, I'm not sure this is going to be on my list of favorites for the year.
Nope, me neither. I mean, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
No, definitely not.
No, but yeah, it doesn't, for me, hold a candle to the first film in terms of sort of capturing that. Like, if this was a completely standalone film and there had been no other Jurassic Parks, I still don't think that I would have liked this a whole lot, because I feel like these plot holes are pretty big. and you could drive like a Jeep Sahara through them. But
there's just in this one, it feels like there's a lot of separation between the things people say and then the things that they do. And a lot of times they say really smart stuff and then do really dumb stuff. And then, you know, to varying degrees throughout the movie. But it's just it doesn't have the cohesion that the first one did, where everything made sense and worked together and you could understand where these characters were coming from, what they were doing. In this one, it is to a point just kind of relentless chaos with dinosaurs.
And there were characters in the first film.
Yeah.
The characters had development through the film. And in this one, like they don't. Like it's basically just Bryce Dallas Howard learning that she can let her hair down and not worry about like the business side of things and take care of stuff and survive and be more like Chris Pratt, I guess.
She could roll up her white linen sleeves or whatever and then tie a little bow out of her shirt or something. But
I did laugh a little at that scene a little bit.
Where he basically said, what is that supposed to mean?
She huffs and she's like, that means I'm ready. I'm still pretty sure that Bryce Dallas Howard mostly gets cast in things because of Ron Howard, because I don't find her to be a particularly effective actress in many of the roles that she's cast in. This is not really an exception for me. I wasn't totally won over by her. Her frigidness I totally buy, but I don't know. Like, you know, most of it probably is the fault of the way the character was written. So it's probably unfair to malign her too much for that. But,
She's great in The Help, but this role is just leaves something to be desired. Like, I know that, again, it does a lot of the same things that the original Jurassic Park did with, you've got sort of the ensemble there, you've got the kids, you've got the couple and all of these sorts of things, but I don't know who to root for in this movie. I guess everybody all at the same time, but like, I don't know or care enough about these people to root for them. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. Also, another thing that was pointed out to me by Jason after we got out of the film, he's like, hardly anybody died. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, people died left and right. And he says, well, nobody, like, and I was like, oh, you mean nobody, like, really cared about died?
Nobody, like, of consequence?
Yes. Like, in the film, basically, only Zara and Vincent D'Onofrio's character and Mr. Masrani are the ones that die that have any sort of, like, establishment at all as characters. Everybody else is just completely just like cannon fodder in the background. So
maybe since so few characters died, is the reason that they had to make them brutally violent.
I suppose, but I would have been.
No, I'm being sarcastic. Oh, no, okay. That was completely unnecessary.
I would have preferred. I'm fine with killing as many people as you want to. I would just like. I didn't feel anything when they like killed the ACU guys or like any of that stuff, because it's just like I didn't get to know them. Like, I don't feel anything for them. Like, when the Marines die in Aliens, like, you have already come to know them a little bit by that point in the film. And you don't necessarily want to see them die. Even the kind of the jerks in the Marines, you don't want to see them die. And so that I find to be particularly effective as a storytelling tool, because then you're like, oh, God, there's stuff that's happening to these people we were introduced to. With the ACU guys, it's like, you don't know anything about them. They grabbed some battery packs and like made some charging noises when they loaded it up. And then, you know, the one guy said, I can camouflage, dead. And then,
I think there was a little validity to that, because the one point where, you know, the scene where the Indominus Rex first gets out and it starts attacking everyone, I did like how it represented, like, look, if you screw up once, this is what happens. And when it gets out, you expect, like, yep, it's like all of these people in remotely close proximity, you're all going to die. You all have to die for these people to understand the gravity of what they just did. And I guess it helped that we weren't super invested in the military folks who were out there trying to capture it again. It's just like, that's what has to happen for everyone to get into their heads. Like, this is the consequence of the stupid thing that you just did. So you should learn from that and move forward from here. But that wasn't really carried throughout the rest of the movie. Like, I think it would have been okay for the Indominus Rex to just bust out and it's like, well, I'm here now and all of you people are going to die because that is what I do. I kill humans because you are tiny and I am psychotic because you raised me to be this. And that is a theme that they could have worked with. But then after that, it was just like, a couple people died and then it's just going to menace a lot of people and the, you know, other, you know, the pterodactyls are going to grab some people and stuff like that. But it was just, I don't know. They didn't play up. I liked that part, but they didn't play it up really toward the end of the movie when things were presumably starting to get more violent and serious.
No, I didn't like it. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm still I thought that was okay. I'm super bummed out about what they did with Zara, and then that's about it. But there's not a whole lot else in there.
I just wish we knew more of the people in the film that they were killing, because it was sort of inconsequential cannon fodder, and it just made the characters on screen sad, even though we don't get a hint that they really knew each other, other than Zara. And when Zara dies, and the kids look on in horror, then no one talks about Zara being dead for the rest of the film. No one's like, oh, I really miss my assistant Zara. Nope. None of that. So... Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not great. But I think that we've covered covered a lot of ground here.
Covered as much ground as an Indominus Rex that's quickly moving south.
Yes. Or north, or to the west, or the east, maybe.
Oh, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. Did you ever read any of the books?
No.
Because if I recall correctly, the camouflaging skin thing was a plot point in the Lost World book, which I was super bummed wasn't actually in the Lost World movie. And I'm kind of glad it's in here. I mean, it turned out to be completely ridiculous, but I kind of wanted to see how that would translate into a movie back when I read the book, and now I've seen it. And it's kind of interesting. It could have been interesting if, like, that was the only thing they did, but then the rest of this movie became this movie.
Well, also, it only camouflaged once.
Yes. Well, like the whole part where it was white, I couldn't tell if like that was it being camouflagey or not, but
I think that was its default. It was just sort of like its default gray, like 0.18. so that's a normalized color space joke for everyone at home.
You can white balance your cameras off the Indominus Rex.
Yes. Well, please don't do that. It didn't really do anything for me. Oh, and, you know, since this is, I guess, a special effect, visual effects podcast, and people so frequently confuse it with special effects and, like, on-set puppets and stuff like that, and how, you know, the first Jurassic Park is better because it relies more heavily on puppets, I would just like to say that I didn't necessarily miss the puppets, and I don't think that the fact that puppets are used is really the strength of the first film. I think the fact that you're looking at the dinosaurs themselves on screen less is why it works better. Because then you're not just watching them do ridiculous stuff for like a 5-minute stretch where they're smashing into buildings. Like even if they had done that with like the practical real life scale versions of the T-Rex puppet that they had, you know, that thing was like crushing a truck and stuff. But most of the time you're focusing on the truck collapsing, not on the big wide shot of the dinosaur doing it. So, you know, it has a different effect that way. And so all this stuff about like how, you know, CG is the reason why the film doesn't work for some people is, I think, kind of BS.
Very much so. Yeah. You know, the direction of the dinosaurs, especially the T-Rex in the first one, it was more natural and more subtle. Like, it actually behaved kind of like an animal. Like, when it first got out, it didn't really care about the people. You know, it was going to poke around and sniff around and explore, and it stomped on the Jeep, and it bit the tire off the Jeep and that sort of thing. But it didn't just go like, I see an animal and I'm immediately going to try and eat it because that's what I do. Like, in this one, they tried to play a little bit on the suspense, and I thought it got a little old, especially by the time we got back to the original visitor center, where the Indominus Rex just did the tribute thing that the T-Rex did, where it like slowly pokes its face in, where it's sniffing and looking around, and then it backs out and then it attacks. Like, I know what they were trying to do in this one. It just did not work as effectively as the ones in Jurassic Park 1, because in Jurassic Park 1, it really just felt like the T-Rex was sort of exploring and looking around and stuff. And it's like, hang on a second, there's a light coming out of this car. I'm going to go down there and look. And then it's like, you know what? This thing's kind of annoying me, and I'm going to thrash my head around in there and try and attack it. But in this one, Indominus Rex was just like full-blown predator mode, like Predator, the movie Predator. It was just, I didn't like the way it was. There certainly was a lot more of it, but it was also just directed in a way that was just like, all right, Indominus Rex and a human are in this scene. It's immediately going to have to just go straight for them and try and kill them.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, that's all I got, other than it's really sweaty and hot in here.
I'm also burning up. I'm going to die. And it won't be a dinosaur that killed me.
It's probably similarly warm down there in Costa Rica, though.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But it's really kawaii, so hopefully kawaii is okay with the trade ones.
Hmm. When you go there, are you going to visit any of the memorable spots where they shot the movie?
I think I would need a helicopter for that.
Hmm. You should get a helicopter.
Yes, I'll get right on that.
You can learn how to fly, like Mr. Mazzani.
And then when we go up there in the helicopter, I'll just go, dun 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 dun, and the helicopter guy will be like, we're going to land. We're going
to
land right now.
You need to stop that right now.
Yeah.